Coming up on Boston Public Radio, day four of the partial government shutdown, day four of health care exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. But does America understand Obamacare? Then Callie Crossley will join us to discuss a tale of two Bostons as a peace activist in Roxbury loses her sixth family member to gun violence. Then John Boehner and Barack Obama can't cut a deal. Well, we'll be joined by MSNBC's Chris Matthews, author of a wildly relevant new book, Tipping the Gipper, When Politics Worked.
Emily Rooney joins us on Yohar Tsarnaev's imprisonment, Boston police arresting a legendary local icon, and her world-famous Emily's List. Not complaints, but observations. I can't wait. Then our weekly news quiz featuring a battle between operators of two great local bookstores, Brookline Booksmith and Porter Square Books. All that up next on Boston Public Radio.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. Speaker of the House John Boehner says it's time for real negotiations to begin in Washington. And as the October 17th deadline approaches on the national debt ceiling, Boehner is telling reporters that federal spending will be part of the larger picture that Congress will consider in any debt limit action.
I don't believe that we should default on our debt. It's not good for our country. But after 55 years of spending more than what you bring in, something ought to be addressed.
House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi says no progress has been made toward ending the government shutdown because, in her words, GOP leaders cannot rein in their Tea Party faction. Both the House and Senate are in session today. NPR's S.V. Date reports Republicans are pushing ahead with legislation to fund the government on a piecemeal basis.
House Republicans entered the debate insisting that a spending bill to keep the government running past September 30th had to take away all funding from the president's health care law. But ever since the shutdown began Tuesday, House leaders instead began trying to pass smaller bills to pay for programs that are popular with the public. That strategy continues today with bills funding disaster relief and baby formula. Senate Democratic leaders argue that they've already passed a bill paying for all of these programs a week ago and that the House can pass that bill at any time. S.V. Date, NPR News.
Several hundred New Yorkers who are still homeless from Hurricane Sandy are asking for more time before they have to leave their hotel rooms. As NPR's Joel Rose reports, city officials say they will not pay for those rooms after today.
Nearly 300 people are still sleeping in city-funded hotel rooms almost a year after Sandy. New York City officials say it's time to end the hotel program now that FEMA is no longer picking up the bill, totaling more than $70 million since the storm. But advocates say many of those still staying in hotels are close to finding permanent housing and just need a few more weeks. That includes Sherelle Manuel of Queens.
We're next to be devastated by Sandy. All we want the city is to give us more time, more help.
City officials say they've helped 1,400 households move from hotels to permanent housing since the storm, but they concede that some of the evacuees may wind up in homeless shelters. Joel Rose, NPR News, New York.
The first tropical storm of the season is expected to hit U.S. land. Hovering in the Gulf of Mexico, forecaster Jack Bevin with the National Hurricane Center says there's a potentially widespread landfall area.
There is considerable uncertainty as to the landfall location, as we have models that are spread all the way from the southern Louisiana coast all the way to the western Florida panhandle.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 44 at 15,040, the NASDAQ up 24. This is NPR.
Good afternoon from the WGBH Radio Newsroom in Boston. I'm Marilyn Scherer with the local stories we're following this Friday at noon. A fugitive with ties to former New England Patriots player Aaron Hernandez has been taken into custody in Connecticut. The U.S. Marshals Service says Alexander Bradley of East Hartford was found this morning at a residence in Hartford. Bradley has alleged in a civil lawsuit that Hernandez shot him in the face in February after they argued at a Miami strip club. He failed to appear in court last month after being ordered to appear before a grand jury in Suffolk County. The panel is investigating a 2012 shooting in Boston, which has been linked to the former NFL star. East Bridgewater police say a 27-year-old Brockton man is facing charges of stealing a change jar from the lobby of the police station. Surveillance video shows the man looking around to make sure no one is watching, then slipping the jar into the pocket of his hooded sweatshirt before heading for the exit. Police say the man was brought to the station to fill out a no trespassing order, but hadn't been arrested. Police say the jar raises money for the anti-drug
drug DARE program and had between $15 and $20 in it. A Maine man who's devoted himself to honoring the memory of poets from the past has now visited 300 graves of poets ahead of this weekend's fourth annual Dead Poets Remembrance Day. Walter Scold of Freeport reached the 300 grave milestone Monday when he visited the burial sites of three poets in Mount Auburn Cemetery in Cambridge. Scold also helped create the Remembrance Day, which kicks off today and continues through the weekend with poetry readings at burial sites in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Illinois, and California. Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, presenting T. Rowe Price Connections, a series exploring opportunities in the golden economy at TRoePrice.com/connections. And the American League Divisional Series gets underway at Fenway Park at 3 p.m. today as the Red Sox host the wild-card winning Tampa Bay Rays. Cloudy this afternoon with scattered showers, temperatures in the mid-60s. Right now, 63 in Boston. This is WGBH. I'm Marilyn Shera.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
And hey to you, Marjorie. So it's day four, not just of a partial government shutdown, but of healthcare exchanges across America. A bunch of you have emailed me and Marjorie objecting to our description of how difficult it is to understand and to choose among plans, and that the president has done less than a stellar job of explaining the law to America. Well, a recent Kaiser poll finds that as of this week, only 1 in 8 Americans were aware they could sign up for Obamacare this week. And on top of that, Marjorie, 51% of those polled overall and 67% of those currently uninsured said they still don't have enough information about the Affordable Care Act to know how it works. And if these numbers seem too abstract to drive home how confusing Obamacare actually may be, Jimmy Kimmel simplified things and took this issue to the streets.
We're talking about health care today. And which plan do you support, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act?
The Affordable Care Act.
And what is it about Obamacare that you do not like?
I just think that there's a lot of holes in it, and it needs to be revamped.
You think the Affordable Care Act is a better plan than Obamacare? Right.
Better.
So Obamacare is un-American?
I think it's kind of un-American to force people. What if they can't afford it? What if they want more coverage?
And the Affordable Care Act is American.
I think it's more American because it allows people to make their own choices on what they want and who they want to work with.
Do you agree with the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare?
The Affordable.
And why do you prefer the Affordable Care Act over Obamacare?
I just don't agree with the whole Obamacare policy thing that's going on. I just don't agree with it.
Makes sense to me.
Oh, God.
Over the last few weeks, it seems, Marjorie, like comedians are doing a better job than the media or the White House at explaining Obamacare. It's something Callie Crossley pointed out. We're going to talk about this with her in a couple of minutes, but we thought it deserved its own treatment with you. So at 877-301-8970, whether you are for or against the Affordable Care Act, do you feel you understand it, either as an engaged citizen or a potential applicant? Here's your opportunity to voice your criticism of our take and to share with us yours. 877-301-8970 is the number. By the way, the email is very measured and very substantive that we get here, some critical, some in support. However,
people have
been really up in arms about the fact that we had a couple of guests this week who are experts on the subject that says it is confusing, it is complicated. And I think the consensus, even amongst big-time Democratic supporters of the president, is he has not done a wonderful job of marketing his namesake, probably the thing that will most be remembered about his presidency.
But I don't know why we should be all that surprised or, you know, say it's a terrible idea because of this, because when you've signed up for anything, you know, when you're trying to get your health care through whatever it is, Tufts or Blue Cross, or it's very confusing. You go, we said this before, you go to your HR people at your workplace and they help you through it. I mean, try figuring out your mortgage if you don't have a lawyer there to help you understand these things. I mean, these things are very complicated, so it's not a surprise. And it's been said a million times before, but I'll say it again. Just like when Social Security began, people had to really tweak that. Or when Medicare began, had to be tweaked. So the fact that it's complicated, should we be shocked?
No, and it's also, as I've said repeatedly to every guest we've had, it's laden with a lot of emotion because it's not, I mean, so is a mortgage, but it's not like a phone or choosing between airlines or choosing between cell phone companies. It's a whole different kind of thing. 877-301-8970, but we're interested in hearing from anybody, but particularly those people who've sat down and spent a lot of time writing us very thoughtful emails, with one or two exceptions, which were not thoughtful at all. But the Limbaugh comparisons, I have to say, don't go get very
Limbaugh,
far with me.
I miss those.
Yeah, there were a couple of those. But this is your opportunity to say you think you get it. And by the way, one of the things that that I think when we were talking to Trudy Liebman the other day from the Columbia Journalism Review, if you have the ability to sit down and talk to a human being, they're called navigators,
right.
I guess the thing is, it makes a world of difference. And I agree. If you don't just have to rely upon your own presence and whatever, but are able to sit down with a human being who not only is sympathetic but is there to help you, it's a whole different ball of wax.
And there was a great NPR story on this morning that we played here on WGBH at 89.7 earlier this morning, talking about they went out and interviewed different workers who had applied for Obamacare. And the guy from Home Depot was pretty excited because his coverage under Obamacare was going to be a lot more comprehensive. And he's a part-time worker, by the way. That's why he
had Did he have health insurance of
well,
some
he had,
form before?
He had health insurance through Home Depot, but it wasn't nearly as good, he said, as what he's going to be able to get through Obamacare. Then they interviewed a woman from Trader Joe's. And I guess Trader Joe's, for part-time workers, offered a pretty good deal. So she was unhappy because she thought that the affordable health care was going to give her not such a great deal. So there's wide variance. And one of the big variables is where you live. In a lot of these places, a lot of these states that have not expanded Medicaid, you're not going to get nearly as good of a deal as you would in a state that had expanded Medicaid. We have a different, unique situation here in Massachusetts.
There are large cost differences from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
Large cost differentiations. And New Hampshire, for reasons I don't understand, is a lot cheaper than some other places. Maybe we should all move to New Hampshire.
By the way, before we get to the calls, speaking of comedians doing a better job, if the media, as we said in the Obama administration, maybe hasn't explained Obamacare, navigators, Stephen Colbert, not only explains what they are, but gets at how some states are actually abusing them.
The key to implementing the president's plan are the so-called Obamacare navigators. Now, what does an Obamacare navigator do?
They helped low-income, uninsured residents sign up for the state's expanded insurance program.
Thank you. Okay. They help you learn about Obamacare. That's why Republican lawmakers are restricting and regulating healthcare navigators in 16 states. They are withholding information from the public, and no one is working harder to keep their citizens in the dark than the Sunshine State.
The State Department of Health put out a notice saying navigators couldn't, quote, conduct activities on the grounds of the health departments.
Yes, we need to keep the healthcare navigators away from the uninsured. Because shouldn't the search for healthcare really be more about the journey?
877-301-8970. Obviously, the great Stephen Colbert. Let's start in Fitchburg with Jim. Jim, you're on Boston Public Radio. Welcome. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Hi.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Do you remember me from the previous radio station?
Actually, Jim.
Familiar voice.
I do remember that voice. It's great to hear from you, Jim. How are you?
I was flicking through the radio. I was listening to you guys the last couple of days. And I'm saying this is a big difference from the other radio stations, Jim. I mean, probably 850 out of a 900. Now agree with you.
I know. I've searched my whole life for this, Jim. But thank God you're there for a little bit of tension. Hey, Jim, so what's up?
Well, I'm just listening to all this thing with the Obamacare thing and Congress and all that stuff. And my thing is I'm a firm believer, let it rise and fall on its own. It's the law. It passed. I don't agree with how it passed. I thought it was kind of dirty fool what was done. But you can't cry over spilt milk. And you got to let it go the way it goes. But my thing is just make sure you tell everybody honestly how it's being run.
Was the last part of that just tell people? We lost you. Tell people honestly how it's being run. Is that what you said?
Be honest about it. You know, bottom line is if 79 people in Connecticut.
Jim, we have a horrible connection. It's great to hear from you. Call us again.
Yeah.
By the way, when he says he's not happy with the way it passed, I assume he's talking about the fact that there were no Republican votes. And a lot of people believe that the president's decision to move ahead with that, Nancy Pelosi in particular. Obviously, it got a majority of votes to become law. The Democrats then had a majority in the House. But it was ensuring that down the road, the Republicans were going to be unhappy.
Well, people say that about a lot of things. You know, a lot of the great movements in the United States have not been decided by Congress. They've been decided by the courts. And then people complain about them for the next 50 years. Let's go to Michael from Framingham. Hi, Michael.
Hey, Michael.
Good day. How are you?
Great.
Fine, thanks.
I wish the people that are saying, it's the law, I'll let it happen, would realize that, first off, it is the House's job to set the budget. Number two, out of the 18 shutdowns that we've had in this country, 15 of those times, the Democrats held the House and forced shutdowns over legal issues with regards to something they didn't like. On the overall Obamacare, so they call it, continually, I'm not against it. There are a lot of really good things in there. I think it's bad to roll it out and have it perform badly because all of the setup issues aren't ready or whatnot. A bad rollout is a bad deal for everybody.
What makes other than the fact that people are going to have to learn as they go, and remember, the sign-up period didn't start and end on October 1st. It started on October 1st, and I believe it goes for 6 months to March 31st. You don't have to. You can go online today, tomorrow. It may take a few extra minutes. Learn a little bit. Go set up an appointment with a navigator, apparently, except in Florida, maybe, and learn more and then make your decision 4 or 5 months down the line. Is that not a fair characterization?
Well, I think the sign-up thing should continue and move forward. But as far as the fact that I have a feeling that overall it's unfair. You've got all the big businesses that have exemptions, the small businesses that are exempt from the mandate case. At the end of the day, I'm actually not affected at all. I'm one of the fortunate persons that is exempt. I'm a Native American by law, and therefore I'm not affected by the individual mandate, but it is my country. And I see that there's enormous turmoil and everybody's all upset. The fact is, if you make less than $16,000 a year, you're not affected by it because you're going to be under Medicaid.
But before you go ahead, what big small businesses are
live
what big businesses what big businesses are exempt from this, Michael?
Well, General Motors has an exemption going to where they don't have to.
You mean because of their own coverage?
Right.
Well,
like Congress is exempt. They don't have to be inside the
system
either.
You know, Michael, I just learned this today, and I'm embarrassed to say I just learned this today, but get the Boston Globe. They have a long story. Congress is not exempt, and neither is its staff. They have to go on Obamacare. I just learned this today, which is an example, because that's been thrown around nonstop. They have a very long explainer. The difference between Congress and their staff and other people is that they're going to get a federal subsidy to help them buy their insurance, but they are not exempt.
You know, Michael, your call is a perfect second call because you sound like a relatively smart guy. I like to think that Marjorie and I are relatively smart as well.
What did you say?
And the three of us are having a disagreement, not about opinion, but about fact. Michael, thank you for the call.
I'm reading the story this morning and I said, Jim, did you know this, that Congress and their staff has to go buy Obamacare? You didn't know it?
I didn't know it.
I mean, we're paying attention.
But let me tell you, one of the things, we've done three segments this week prior to this one with experts on this issue about the Affordable Care Act, and we're going to continue to do this. We just thought it was an opportunity for people to voice their concerns, raise their questions, and those which we can't answer, we promise you we will get answers, and you'll get them in the near future. Let's go to Newbury, where Susan is on Boston Public Radio. Susan, thanks so much for the call. Hi.
Hi. Is this too loud? I'm on speakerphone?
No, perfect.
No, you sound great.
It's the best speakerphone actually I've ever heard.
I'm calling. I just kind of mind.
Oh, actually, you now do have to take us off speakerphone. There's an echo. I apologize.
Okay, sorry.
It's okay.
I'm just kind of mind blown that people in Massachusetts are so confused. We've had this great program for what? How long have we had this Commonwealth MassHealth?
A couple of years. Yeah,
we like to call it Romney Care.
Years, and we're all used to it. And how do people not? You know, I don't think you have to understand all the details before you go sign up for something. You learn about it when you go sign up. It's just mind-boggling, people complaining. And then elderly complaining about government programs, and they're happy to get Medicare. Do they turn down Medicare? Do they tear up their cards?
No, but Susan, let's be fair to seniors for a second. If you polled, I'm not saying you're not. If you were to poll Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, early on, that was before the president was okay with it being called Obamacare. He said he sort of likes it now. Do you know what the one feature of Obamacare in early polling was the only one that the largest percentage of Americans knew about?
What?
Death panels, which don't exist.
Oh, right,
And because Sarah Palin, frankly, did a better job of disinformation in the early days of the Affordable Care Act than the president's people did for providing information. So I agree with you. It's there now. People have 6 months to try to get it. But I think it's unfair to suggest to people that it's just, at least in my estimation, that it's simple. I went online the other day. I mentioned this on the air. I went as a citizen of Maine because I originally went to Massachusetts. And then I realized you get automatically connected to the health connector.
You went incognito and undercover.
I went to Maine and I did some comparisons after filling out the demographics. And it's a little confusing. And it's because half because it's an emotional topic, and half because health coverage is just innately a fairly confusing thing. But Susan, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
But, you know, again, think of your own life with your insurer when something has happened to you or one of your kids that you thought was going to be covered, and then you found out it wasn't covered. I mean, this just happened to me. I had my toe operation. You know, they charged me for...
Oh, tell us all about that, Margaret, if you would, please.
They charged
How
me for the
surgery?
The cast. And I thought, I have to pay for the cast? I didn't know I had to pay for the cast. How are you supposed to get out of the hospital without the cast?
Yeah, and by the way, again, maybe we are outliers, Marjorie and I. And if we are, again, feel free to call and criticize. Generally, I find out what kind of health coverage I have, despite the fact, by the way, that when we had our first day here, we got an extensive training from the GBH HR people. I usually find out what health coverage is when I file a claim.
Exactly.
And someone says, but as you said,
exactly.
Either don't have that coverage or you do have that coverage or there's a $500 per annum deductible. Maybe that obviously isn't the way people should deal with something so seriously, but I think that is fairly typical
for
most Americans.
You know, it's one of the classics when you go to the hospital with the baby and you find out you have to get out like really quickly. You know, you think you're going to be there for 3 or 4 days. That's all over with for most of us anyway. You are in and you are out.
877-301-8990. We're discussing whether or not comedians have done a better job of highlighting this issue. If you didn't see Saturday Night Live, this was a skip.
This is great.
It's the opening last Saturday night where Barack Obama is holding a town hall meeting to explain to America how Obamacare works. And then all of a sudden, a guy whose voice you'll recognize from the late, great Breaking Bad is called up to the podium.
Now, here's a young man from New Mexico with a heartbreaking story about health care. Before the Affordable Care Act. So, Jesse, can you come up here?
Hey. Yeah, I had this friend, you know, and he got sick, like cancer sick. But because there wasn't Obamacare, he couldn't afford the treatments. So he was, like, backed into a corner. You know what I mean?
And keep in mind, this man was a teacher with a family.
He was. So he did what any of us would have done. He started cooking meth.
Okay.
877-301-8970. Obviously, Aaron Paul, a.k.a. Jesse Pinkman in Breaking Bad.
Ryan from Hanover, thank you for calling. What's up, Ryan?
Hey, Ryan.
Hey there. This is actually kind of going back a little bit, but it's having to do with the websites, with the federal government and everything.
Yep.
I actually work for... indirectly for the federal government insurance program.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
All the federal employees, you know, all the post office workers, everything like that. And I'm very confident in the new system, mainly for one reason. They have a claim system that's specifically for federal employees all over the country, and it is perfect. I mean, not like perfect, obviously not perfect. Nothing's ever perfect, but it is, it's pretty impressive. So I have the feeling that once they actually get around to, fixing all these new exchanges, especially the ones that have the federal government helping out, I have a feeling that it's going to be pretty smooth.
Ryan, what is, as an expert in the field, which obviously neither Marjorie nor I am, what does perfect mean in terms of what federal public employees have?
Organization-wise, mostly, yep. They do massive system updates four times a year, and every time they do a system update, you know, they make all the changes to the diagnosis codes that you need, everything like that. But they tell us way ahead of time, and, you know, they have extremely thorough testing and everything like that, which is partially my job. But, I mean, they really seem to have it down in the whole federal world there.
Well, the beauty is also the 800,000 federal employees have tons of time to navigate the site right now. So, Ryan, thank you for the call. By the way, you know, there's a Republican bill up before the House of Representatives today that would up front. Well, on day four is not quite up front, but rather than waiting till the end and then doing it retroactively, if they do it at all, say that when the shutdown ends, that federal employees will be paid retroactively. Apparently, Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, has said that they will vote no should it make its way out of the House. 877-301-8970. We're discussing whether or not, frankly, comedians and others have done a better job of highlighting some of the issues around Obamacare than the media and the president's team have.
You know, the gentleman was just talking that just called about fixing the exchanges.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Maybe you know this, Jim. Do you have to get a bill passed through Congress to tweak the exchanges so they work a little bit better? Because that could be the death knell of these exchanges if you have to get these Republicans and Democrats to agree about applying changes.
You're kidding, right? You are.
I was kidding, but you know, not
entirely.
It's
an administrative thing. But let me just say, in all fairness, since I'm one of the two here that's saying this is relatively complex and confusing, the sites are pretty clean. At least the site that I went onto is pretty clean, pretty understandable. But it doesn't mean that it's not a daunting thing, because you think, well, how's the family going to be affected under this? How am I going to be affected? I mean, there are a lot of variations that you need. Again, the human being the navigator is, to me, the key for this thing to be working.
Let's go to – where are we going? We're going to Joanne from Southbridge. Hi, Joanne.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to say that I, too, when I had a job, when the human resources explained, that's how I would put down for my health insurance.
Yeah.
I think Massachusetts is, I think they did a really good job. I didn't have any problems. I'm below poverty level, so I was eligible for my health insurance was fine. But the only problem that arose was there was a friend of mine, she was a retired military, and Massachusetts didn't have a form, or the federal didn't have a form for her to file her state taxes. She couldn't get a form from the federal government because it hadn't established it yet.
So how did she resolve her difficulties?
Well, as far as I know, she's still struggling to get her taxes, and this was a couple of years. It's been a couple of years. So it hasn't been resolved. I don't know if they've come up with a form for it as yet or if that's one of those glitches.
Well, Joanne, you're the first who's posed the question I think neither of us has any idea about.
I don't know.
And we will try to get you an answer early next week. Joanne, thank you so much for the call.
You know, Jeff makes a good point. He says, we all know the behemoth that is the U.S. government will probably never be entirely ready to roll out the Affordable Care Act, but incremental change is how we move the country forward. And also, I get an email here from someone who works in benefits, and she said she worked in benefit implementation for 5 years for three top 100 corporations. She said, regardless of the amount of information clients get about how plans work and what they cost, benefits are typically misunderstood and or difficult to understand, and the more options, the more confused people get. And that's a great point, because you do have, what is it, the bronze plan, the silver plan, the gold plan, the platinum plan. You have to decide, you know, do you want to pay for higher premiums, or do you want to have more coverage, or do you want to risk it and have the low premium and then hope you don't get sick and need it? I mean, it is. Now, I'd be there for like a month.
No, and by the way, for those who are people
planning, I can't sign on to iTunes.
For those who are planning right now to send an email saying, I can't believe Marjorie is saying that, I'm going to say something that's going to make you add a paragraph. How about when you go to a restaurant? This follows up on how often have you said to yourself, this menu is too big? There are too many choices here. I want a limited number of choices. This is just human nature. And I'll quote myself for the 14th time.
Fish, Jim.
It is probably the most emotional choice you're going to make in terms of buying something, enrolling in something. And understandably, that's going to be difficult. And by the way, the tenor, I think, of the emails, even though very few of them say it, to suggest that this is complex or they haven't done a great job of selling is tantamount to being an indictment of Obamacare. It's not neither an indictment nor an embrace. It's just saying what I think is the reality. And polls suggest it's the exact same thing.
Well, I'm embracing it. I mean, what my greatest hope is that 6 months from now, we'll have millions and millions and millions of Americans insured that never had insurance before. And this will take the wind out of the sails of these people that are
Well, maybe. But I don't think that's the real test, Marjorie. I think the real test is a compassionate nation is if we have virtually no uninsured. The rubber meeting the road test is what does it do for premiums for the 90% of Americans who are insured? And that's one of the reasons, ways I think they've done a rotten job marketing. It isn't that we're not compassionate. Who were we having this discussion with just a couple of days ago who agreed with me on this is that while we like to think that we are a compassionate lot in this country. When you're in a tough economy and you're struggling by yourself, you generally, your first thoughts are about yourself. That's not a horrible thing. And if your first thought is about yourself and you're one of the vast majority of Americans who have health insurance that you think is unaffordable, the question is, what is the Affordable Care Act going to do for you?
But let's not, you know, it isn't just the people that can't afford insurance. And I'm sure lots of people know individuals in this exact same circumstance. A classic is someone who has had cancer, and they've had cancer when they're in their 40s or their 50s, and they've recovered and they're fine. Then they lose their job. Then they try to get insurance because they have had cancer.
Right.
Try to find insurance when you've had cancer or you have, MS or you have a bunch. I mean, that's why the pre-existing condition thing is such a breakthrough. Because, or people that have who've had dread diseases that they've needed a lot of treatment for, and then they've run out of the policy won't cover them anymore. They said you've reached your limit for coverage.
Right.
I mean, this happens to people that are in their 40s and 50s, even younger, I'm sure, if you get sick when you're
speaking of younger, let's go to the opposite end of the spectrum, which is why I think you and I agree that this matters and is long overdue, some variation on universal health coverage. It's not just to protect those who have been quite sick in their lives. It's to require that those who haven't been sick at all and think they're invincible, particularly 20-something young men, that they have to buy in. It's the only way you can make the whole program affordable is if the well are part of those who are covered.
Exactly why delaying the mandate is so frightening, because it means
the individual mandate.
Yes, because then you're not going to have the money, at least part of the money, to afford to pay for the coverage of people who do have significant health insurance needs. Let's go to Steve in Boston. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Marjorie. Marjorie, as to Congress, it's not a matter of Congress's, going into Obamacare. It's that they're being treated differently. They don't have to qualify for the tax breaks. They automatically get a stipend. Whereas here,
that's true. They get
subsidy.
Money.
Yep,
they get
they
a
do.
Subsidy.
So they don't have to qualify. They're making $200,000 a year, and they get it. A person that makes $50,000 a year, the average American, gets nothing.
Well, wait a minute, Steve. The staffers aren't making it. I think the Congress salary, by the way, is $174,000, unless you're like Speaker of the House or something. But
right.
The staffers, there's a lot of people that work there that are making much less than that, $40,000 and $50,000 and $60,000. These kids out of college, they're administrative assistants. They're not making that kind of money.
Yeah, but they're making some money where the average middle American doesn't qualify for.
No, your basic point is they're getting a better deal, and the answer is they are getting a better deal.
Well, they're being treated differently. That's the whole thing.
Agreed.
The law is treating people differently. Well, anyways, I try to go on Obamacare, on healthcare.gov and stuff like that. It immediately kicked me over because I'm a map to the health connector here.
Yeah, me too.
I found maybe it's because we've been doing it for some years here, but that was simple. It's expensive.
Well, not only is it relatively simple, comparatively speaking, it's also just been redone. I actually have Gene Yang, who's the head of the Healthcare Connector, on my television show tonight to explain how Massachusetts fits within this grand scheme of things. But one of the things I know she's talking about is they've had a total revamp based upon experience. And you're right. They've had years of experience here as opposed to the feds who've had 4 days of experience. Steve?
But the thing is that it's expensive. And if unless you qualify for some of these income breaks, it really is not affordable for most people. And kids who have college loans and are paying $200 or $300 or $400 a month, I'm not going to want to pay another $200 or $300, $400 a month.
Well, but Steve, one of the beauties, and thank you for the call, of the Affordable Care Act, which is, in my opinion, one of the few things that most parents know about, is you can keep your kid on your own insurance till 26, which at least in the vast majority of states is a higher age and a great savings for both the kid, even if he or she picks up the cost, or the parent. Let's take one more, Marjorie.
Also, we should point out that in some of the plans with the lower premiums, those are the bronze and silver ones, the premiums are pretty low if you are
but the co-pays and the deductibles can be such that you can't afford to use
but
the health insurance you have.
The average 25-year-old man is not spending a lot of time going to the doctor unless they happen to be somewhat of a hypochondriac, and we all know about that, Jim.
Had a couple of MRIs in my life. Yes, I have. Peter in Boston, you're going to wrap it up for us right here on Boston Public Radio. Thank you for the call. Hi, Peter.
Yeah, question. Now, the Affordable Care Act and Obamacare is one and the same, right?
Yep.
Correct.
Yeah, but yet I was listening to you guys earlier, and when you asked the question using both names, so I don't like the Obamacare, but I like the Affordable Care Act. I mean, what that shows is how people can be biased against something or even understand just because they're being manipulated to think something else other than that.
Well, it's one of two things. That was a Jimmy Kimmel, person on the street thing. It means one of two things, that the appeal of the word affordable is great, or the lack of appeal, at least in the minds of some, of the word Obama in Obamacare is pretty great as well. So I think that's what it demonstrated.
Now, the quick question I want to ask you before you go now, if the Republicans believe that this is such a bad plan, why, like many other people say, let it fail on its own? It don't need any help, right? So it seems as though they're working to make it fail as opposed to letting it fail on its own, and I think people need to realize that. So,
well, the flip of that, the flip is, Peter, that many Democrats at least believe that the Republicans' greatest fear is that now that people can actually enroll and are going to get to understand it more, they're going to like what they're enrolling in, which is going to make the likelihood of repeal or major modification much less likely.
I'm neither Democrat or Republican, but I'm in agreement with that. I think it's a fear that it's going to be successful, like Social Security and other plans that are safe at the American people, you know, and that's a sad thing.
Peter, thanks, Nicole.
I also think, not to impugn anyone's motives, but I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think at least one of two of the people, the Tea Party people that are so opposed to Obamacare, basically want it to fail because they don't want his signature achievement of his first term to stand.
Well, or ideologically, they may just be a totally anti-government person who happens to be serving in government, which is an odd sort of oxymoronic thing.
Okay, when we come back, we're going to talk to Callie Crossey because she pointed out to us this whole thing about the comedians having this great take on Obamacare. We're going to talk to her about that and also some other stories that were over and under the radar this week, including a really almost unbearable family tragedy in the city of Boston. That's next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Mel King is a giant in the history of Boston.
Issues of race have to, in my opinion, and something that I've worked on pretty much all of my life, be confronted with a belief that people can change.
I'm Adam Riley. Join us for a very special conversation with Mel King, Sunday night at 6 here on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and the Solstice MFA in Creative Writing Program of Pine Manor College in Chestnut Hill, offering concentrations in fiction, creative nonfiction, poetry, and writing for young people. pmc.edu/MFA. And Grogan & Company Fine Art Auctioneers and Appraisers, presenting their upcoming fall auction, October 13th and 14th in historic Dedham, Massachusetts. You can view their online catalog at groganco.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to talk about stories that were under the radar, some that were over the radar, as the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. It airs right here on the station, WGBH Radio, every Sunday night at 6:30. Hello there, Callie Crossley.
Hi, Jim Browdy. Hi, Marjorie Egan.
Did you want to say something important, Callie
Crossley? Yeah, I just want to add one thing to Jim's observation on the Obamacare discussion, and that is the Cheesecake Factory.
The menu!
There are nine
right.
pages of items, and people flock there. You can't get in there.
Yeah.
So it's clearly not a matter of too much choice. It's about what you feel comfortable choosing.
Well, may I disagree with you? I would argue that people go there not because there's a huge amount of choice, but because the portions are the size of the Great Lakes. They have the largest portions in the history of the restaurant business.
I hate that. I don't like that. I want everything on one page, chicken, meat, or fish.
But
you
I'm
know?
Just saying it's
or
not.
Vegetarian.
I mean, for some it may be intimidating. That's why some don't go. But I'm just saying a lot of people do go. So it's a matter of figuring out. You know, you need to have a grown-up day like I have when you just say, okay, today I'm dealing with it. I'm going to read this.
I haven't had those days lately, Kelly.
I'm tackling that Cheesecake Factory menu. I'm going to wrestle it to the ground. Okay, we're going to continue our discussion about the comedians doing a better job, perhaps, than the media has or the politicians have explaining the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. And in order to explain how Obamacare works, Jennifer Hudson, she was out there teaming up with Funny or Die to make a parody based on the TV show Scandal.
In the cutthroat world of D.C., Lydia Cole cuts through the BS.
Are you my contact?
We have a bit of a scandal. She takes seemingly impossible scandals and makes them go poof.
Thanks for coming, Fixer.
No problem, Senator.
It's my mistress. She's pregnant.
Finally, an actual scandal.
She, doesn't have health insurance. Okay. Thank you, Fixer.
The ACA takes about 15 minutes to sign up for. Why don't you go to healthcare.gov?
Dot com? C-O-M?
Gov.
Well, that's perfect.
There you go.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, my wife and I are splitting quite amicably, and my constituents fully approve.
That's my favorite part. My constituents fully approve.
They're down with it. So you're getting quite a chuckle out of this, Callie Crossley over there. You are down with the premise that the comedians have done a better job, including Little Miss Jennifer Hudson there?
Absolutely. Of course, it's based on Scandal, which is one of my favorite shows. But I thought that the way, and every scandal, quote unquote, that's brought to her in this Funny or Die skit is something that explains some part of the Affordable Care Act. It's just hilarious. It's explained very clearly. So people could sort of laugh and then say, oh, that's what it means. You know, I think they've done a great job in making it clearer to people. And sometimes they can, as we know.
This is part of the president's plan, too, to get all these famous people to go out and try to run these ads to explain things to people. So she's part of that bandwagon. Jennifer Hudson, is she not?
I think she's a supporter of the president, but she didn't write the skit. She's just acting in it. I just think it's interesting that, you know, somebody thought, you know, this will be funny and we can accomplish a couple of things. Actually, you know, Funny or Die has done that once before. Remember when Paris Hilton got caught up in that some discussion about the I think it was the debt ceiling crisis, mm-hmm. and they quoted her, misquoted her, and then they had her say what the actual thing was. But the bottom line is that anytime you have this or Jimmy Kimmel really showing people in a funny way, it is accessible. Here's what it means, and here's what it doesn't mean. It can go a long way to help people understand what's going on.
Are you of the school that we are of and have been criticized for relatively roundly, maybe that's too strong a term, by some of the listeners, that the president himself, who is a pretty good communicator, has come up a little short on the explainer end of this thing?
I've said that back when he was trying to get the health care bill pushed through. To begin with, I really didn't understand then at that point. To me, the only line he should have said over and over again, if in fact people are saying we don't need this because we're employed, hello, it's a jobs thing. You got to have a job. Let's connect and see how many people lost their jobs and are out here with nothing or who have these conditions by which, as Marjorie mentioned earlier, you cannot get insurance after that. I maintain there are so many people, actually, I'm writing about this for my Monday commentary, who you would not think are people who are desperate in need for this insurance. There's an image in our minds of who the uninsured are, and that's just wrong. It's a wide swath of people.
Well, it's not just uninsured. I will state for probably the 19th time I've said it in the last couple of weeks, the largest reason for personal bankruptcy in the United States of America are health insurance bills for those who have health insurance. So there are two classes of people that this is hopefully going to help. One, the uninsured, as you mentioned, Kelly Crossley, and two, the insured who can't afford to use the insurance they have because of absurd copays or deductibles or whatever it is. So there's more than that single universe of the uninsured who need something, and they've got to decide if this is the something.
And back to your point about the president, when Medicaid Part D came in, that was no walk in the park either for a whole lot of people. That's more recent. You know, I think the Bush administration did a better job, maybe, in trying to get this out, even though it was terribly confusing at the time. So we have these historical references to look to when presidents had to step up and say, okay, this is what this is going to mean. It's a huge social change. And I think you can't say it enough. I think you can't say it enough in simple terms. And I wish he would say it more.
Well, you know what's interesting about that? What's the one expression that is the takeaway from that debate under George Bush that I think everybody in America has used? Donut hole.
Yeah.
This whole notion that they'll cover drugs up to a certain point. Yeah. Then there's a place where even if you didn't understand it perfectly, I think everybody in America knew there's some problem with this. There's some piece of this for seniors that's a problem, and at least it would cause them to ask more questions. So in many ways, I think that was a better debate. Speaking of, though, public officials, Marjorie wrote a column the other day. I'm dying to get your sense of this thing because there's been a little bit of debate. Well, why don't you say, what'd you write, Marjorie?
Well, I wrote a column about calls for people in Congress to give up their pay during the furlough. Congress people make $174,000 a year and United States senators. And I called all our delegation and found out that Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey, both our new senators, they're both giving up their paychecks or giving them to charity. And Nikki Tsongas got the whole ball rolling, actually, before anybody else did it, practically. She was out. So kudos to Nikki Tsongas. Today, there are a couple more added to that list. The Globe has got a piece today saying John Tierney, the congressman, not taking a paycheck, and Michael Capuano was undecided. But everybody else in our congressional delegation are taking their paychecks.
I thought you said Joe Kennedy wasn't.
Joe Kennedy is not.
Well, wait, is not I mean, meaning he's not, taking it or he is taking it?
He's taking it. Yes. He has no plans to donate his pay, neither does Stephen Lynch. McGovern is hedging. He may or may not. Richard Neal, undecided.
Before Kelly,
did I leave anybody out? Oh, Keating. Keating did not respond to phone calls.
Before you give your two cents on this, Carolyn Fedoroff, who is with us, who's the regional head of the American Federation of Government Employees, who represents a lot of federal employees in New England, was with us on the radio, and I failed to ask her a question that she answered without my asking on television that night. She does not want, nor does she support the notion that even though her people are sitting at home with no pay.
Yeah, I think she was wrong.
Well, I'm just telling you. I mean, she's a little closer to this than we are. She does not support the notion that Congress people take no pay. And I think her position was because the reality is some can afford to take no pay. Like, for example, the vast majority of senators are millionaires. And the members of the House, who virtually all of them have to have two residences, one back in the district, one in Washington, have families, et cetera.
But she also
it's a real tough nut to crack.
Our show that her average employee was making about 40 grand a year. And they, you know, it's, you can.
Average federal employee. I'm not sure it was her people, but the average federal employee.
Yeah, so you can stretch a little bit more if you're making 174 grand than you can if you're making 40
What's your
grand.
Take on this?
Well, I think my take is that a lot of people are very angry with the people who may have to have two residences. That's a long way from $40,000 a year. I'm sorry. I'm trying to work up some sympathy there, but I just can't. You know, and these are the people that voted on shutting it down. You know, bring it back and then we can have another discussion. I mean, come on. One of the things.
Come on.
I mean, this is
ridiculous.
Yeah,
I'm with you.
You know, and I, you know, on the one hand, I applaud people for giving up the, you know, to making, if even if it's a symbolic statement, giving up their check to go to charity. I wish it could even be more direct if there was a way, because when Jay Leno was out during that period of time where he didn't know he had a job, he didn't have a job, but they laid off his entire staff. He paid.
Yeah.
And kept everybody. They didn't have jobs. He said, that's, you know, because I'm embroiled in some political network thing, that doesn't have anything to do with you. You got to eat. So he paid out of his own pocket for them. Now, you could argue he's a millionaire. He is. But he didn't have to. You know?
That's a great point.
And let me just add this. Joe Kennedy, wherever you are, this looks bad for you.
Terrible.
I got to say, I don't know. It's not my business. I don't know what's in your pocket or not, but it looks really bad.
Well, it is your business, actually. I think it is your business as a taxpayer. And believe it or not, I'm going to be a third vote for your position. I think it is symbolic, but I think it's the right symbolism when the people who work for you, 800,000 to a million of them, are sitting. Not only are they sitting home with no paychecks, by the way, they don't know, despite all the certainty that the so-called pundits are suggesting. They have no idea if there's going to be a vote to either today or retroactively to give them their money when they go back to work.
Yeah, that's a thing that has not been said enough, because there's an assumption, because it has always happened, that people get their back pay. But we've been hearing, as you have stated a couple of times this week, that some people are saying, well, not so fast. You might get it.
You know, we should mention that Jean Shaheen and Kelly Ayotte, the senators from New Hampshire, are also giving up their paychecks during this mess. But one other thing about Nikki Tsongas. Nikki Tsongas was the first one out of the box and giving up her paycheck on this. And then she was the only one in Massachusetts congressional delegation who called for that little slippery, creepy guy, Anthony Weiner, when he was still a congressman, she said after the first round of tweets in his underpants that he had no business being there, he should resign. She was the only one to show that chutzpah. So good for her for doing it twice.
All right.
Hey, can we come back to Boston for a second? A woman we all know is in the paper this morning. We know her because one son was a victim of gun violence, then another son was a victim of gun violence. She lost a nephew a couple of days ago to gun violence, and I was not aware because I've been at events with her, as you have, and interviewed her, Kelly, and I know Marjorie has. Isora Mendez is her name. She's lost four nephews. This is the fourth nephew, six people, two sons and four nephews. She's a peace activist, for those who don't know Isora Mendez. Six people close to her to gun violence in Boston, demonstrating, it seems to me, right in the heat of this mayoral battle, that there are it is a tale of two cities, as Charlotte Gola Ritchie said at the Herald NECN debate. And this highlights it as well as anything, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And plus, I just don't know how she manages, you know, to keep going forward, because it's so horrific. And we've said senseless, and, you know, you can say it over and over again, but it really hits you. And then I started thinking about the Tina Cherrys and the Kim Odoms, you know, two mothers that who've also become active trying to stop the violence, who lost sons.
By the way, today is the sixth anniversary of the date of the killing of Stephen Odom. The parents are going to be with me on TV. Sixth anniversary that 13-year-old Stephen was gunned down.
And he's on his way home from, you know, playing basketball. Yep. And, you know, Tina Cherry's son, you know, same thing.
Louis
you
Brown.
Know, no reason
innocent,
for any
innocent
of this.
Victims.
I know, but it's just so. And I, following up actually from a piece in the Herald several weeks ago, did a commentary about a guy named Paris Haynes who was just gunned down, minding his own business. I mean, we keep saying something has to happen, but it is really incumbent on the new mayor that something concrete has to happen more than going to talk with victims' families, more than saying Tina Cherry is a great gal and, you know, good for you for standing up all these years. I mean, something else has to happen. And there are other cities tackling this in a determined way. In fact, I saw a piece not long ago really focusing on a police officer in Springfield who brought back from Iraq or Afghanistan some of the tactics he learned there and is working hard in a very small way. He had a grant, you know, to work and has seen some change there. I mean, and he breaks down how tough it is to do it. It's just something he wanted to do when he came back. So there are small examples how you, as they say, scale up in the business world so that it affects large communities. I don't know. That's, you know, that's not my expertise. But I do know it's enough to see that some people are doing it in other places, and we have to be serious about it if this is a world-class city.
Well, you know, the mindset is, I think so far, and it's obviously words so far, as you say, I think both of the finalists, Walsh and Connolly, have been pretty good, at least on these issues. Obviously, the question is, where does the rubber hit the road? But when I see Louis D. Brown Peace Institute is the thing that Tina Cherry writes. When I hear Tina, who organizes the Mother's Day March for Peace that we've been at almost every year in Dorchester, talk about forgiveness. Isora Mendez is in the Globe today talking about forgiveness.
Well, they're very religious.
When two sons and four
women.
Nephews mm-hmm. have been taken at the wrong end of a gun, it's superhuman. It's just, and if there are any sets of people, in my opinion, mm-hmm. who deserve attention by political leaders, not those who say, well, that's them. It's not mm-hmm. happening in our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, they don't say it out loud, but that's essentially the message. It's these folks.
You know, I told this to Jen this morning, and it's one of those things as a reporter I'll never forget my whole life, is that we were down, a whole bunch of us, after Isora lost her second son in 2006, after they just come back from a peace conference. And her family was going in and out, and we were all standing out there on the stoop, and you could just hear her wailing, mm. just wailing mm. for about 45 minutes. It was just, you can't even imagine what that pain is like. And now she's lost another nephew, and think about that in your own family.
No, I think
two sons and four nephews.
What kind of cruel irony is this that she's working for peace and this is happening to her, and not just to her, but she's put herself out there to be in, you know, to bring the message and to talk about it. And I give her much credit to have.
Wasn't
that
Louis Brown, Tina's kid, wasn't he going to a pre-Christmas peace
going,
rally
yes,
or something,
yes,
or peace
absolutely.
Meeting or something when he was killed?
Yes.
Yikes.
Yes. And Isora's son was working with her for peace, the second son.
Yeah. Hey, Kelly, speaking of the mayor's race, I am guessing, this is not much of a risky guess, that Under the Radar is going to spend at least a piece of the action Sunday night in the mayoral race. Is that a safe assumption?
Yeah, we're talking about the all-out push by both candidates. I mean, it's a grab to try to get these voters of color, and they are working hard. And it's a little bit different, I think, than may have been in, I'm not talking about comparing them to Mayor Menino. I mean, in other cities where you hear about it, blah, blah, blah. But in this community, and for this vote, this vote in November, these communities can make or break the candidate. So it's very serious to get the numbers up and to get people doing it. Now, here's the other thing that's different about these two candidates, which we can talk. Both of them are not coming to the party for the first time. Remember that when Ayanna Pressley ran at large the first go-round, who went with her? She and Connolly,
that's
John
right.
Connolly, went to each other's quote-unquote communities to, you know, hey, this is Ayanna, John Connolly said.
Almost unheard of, I should say.
And then she said, and hey, here's John Connolly. So that was that. And then we have, you know, Marty Walsh, who instituted that program that he touts in his ads, rightfully so, about trying to make a space in the building trades for people of color. So they both come with some cred already and have more to do and more to say. But this is also different because those candidates of color and others who were in the race who said these are things that have to change now, and I'm not giving up my support easily. I need a commitment from you, something concrete that this is going to happen. So we'll see who can commit and who can go forward with
it. By the way, Charlotte Goler-Ritchie, who is the top vote getter amongst candidates of color, told me on TV, I think two nights ago, that within 5 days, which is three more, she would pick one of the candidates.
Ah.
We had John Barros and Felix Arroyo in studio a couple days ago, both of whom said they've met with both candidates. But one last thing, which I'm sure you're getting to on Sunday night, I asked John Barros why he lost. And while he surely was not saying that he didn't bear some of the blame, obvious, he went on to say communities of color just didn't turn out, you know, despite the fact that there were six candidates of color, five of whom I think were pretty credible. They didn't turn out. So the issue is not could they turn this race? The issue is will they turn out to turn this race? And I guess that job is up to organizers and to the two candidates.
Well, that's true. And I have two great people, Marcela Garcia and Julio Varela, to talk to me about the sleeping giant that is the Latino vote in this town. And, you know, lots of folks got out, but can there be more? And what will it take? This morning, both of those candidates, you won't be surprised, were at the Hispanic Heritage Breakfast.
And they also agreed, after they agreed to only three debates, by the way, one of which Marjorie and I will be moderating on GBH TV and radio, just the last couple of days, they went to a minority forum,
right,
and they agreed to add a fourth debate to address the concerns of communities of color. So at least to me, that's a step in the right direction. Hey, Callie, we'll be listening Sunday night, and thanks so much for stopping by.
All right.
Callie
Crossley is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley, and as we just said, you can catch her Sunday nights at 6:30 discussing all these issues, the mayoral issue particularly. When we come back, MSNBC host Chris Matthews joins us to talk about a time when government actually did work. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Medical information doubles every 5 years. So even the best of the best, right, are continually challenged to keep pace with the rate of change of medicine.
Best of the best humans, that is. I'm Kara Miller. This week on Innovation Hub, we meet the computer that not only beat everyone on Jeopardy, but is also crunching the data that may help us beat cancer. That's Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. You can follow them on Twitter at SAMETZ. And great performances, The Hollow Crown, an acclaimed miniseries that examines four of Shakespeare's most famous history plays. This week, Henry IV, starring Downton Abbey's Michelle Dockery. Friday at 9 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. What a difference a couple of decades make. In the early 80s, Ronald Reagan was president. GOP held a majority in the Senate. House was led by Massachusetts Democrat Tip O'Neill. Despite deep ideological differences, the two leaders made things work. This unusual relationship between O'Neill and Reagan is the subject of a new fabulous book by MSNBC host Chris Matthews. The title, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Works, seems particularly relevant now. Chris Matthews, great to see you.
Thanks, Jim.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Marjorie.
You have a lot of great quotes from Ronald Reagan's diary in your book.
How about the cactus one?
Yeah. I mean, good for him for keeping these diaries, but this is one I wanted to read. Tip is a true pal. He can really like you personally and be a friend while politically trying to beat your head in. How different that strikes me as a relationship between the speaker now, John Boehner, and Barack Obama.
Yeah, I think, this after six thing, we didn't know about it at the time from the speaker. He never mentioned it. But when I first met Ronald Reagan, I met him three or four times when he came up to give the State of the Union. And his holding room was the speaker's ceremonial office, H209, which was right off the House chamber. So when he was in there getting, the dogs would come in and sniff for drugs and everything, bombs, I should say, maybe drugs too, on the floor of the House. The speaker would be gone. He'd be down in his private office, and I'd be out there at my desk right outside that office. So I went in to see the president. I don't know what moved me to do it, but I went and said, Mr. President, welcome to the room where we plot against you. And he said, oh, no, not after six. He said, the speaker says we're all friends after six.
Yeah.
And I heard that. I didn't know what to make of that. And then years later, when the speaker retired and wrote in his memoirs, that was in there.
What's the character? I've read about 100 pages of the book. Marjorie got through the whole thing.
Are you ready for gross?
Well, I'll tell you after you tell the story. Go ahead.
Aren't you sweet?
Go ahead.
Jim, this is about negotiations, which is really a heart of the book, which is how the two guys here, 180, agree in the interest of the country. Let's be honest about it. I don't give a schmaltzy. It's in the interest of the country. And they were in this room, and it was April of 82. And Reagan had started to lose some of his firepower because we're in a recession. And Tip had him. It was getting a little interesting there. And they went in. They knew the Reagan people wanted to cut Social Security. They want to play around with it. And Tip was ready to deal on the issue of maybe we'll give back some of the tax cuts and we'll have to give back on some of the Social Security COLAs. And I was getting real nervous about it. But anyway, that didn't work because we found out that they were trying to blame the Democrats for cutting Social Security, which is an absurdity. So what happened was Jim Wright, who wasn't so adroit in politics as Tip, and he, by the way, I never called him Tip. I called him Mr. Speaker then, but it's faster now, easier too. He offered some bunch of spending cuts, and then he said, and then we'll get rid of the third year of the tax cut. And Reagan said, only Reagan can talk like this in the back room. Okay, guys, I can crap a pineapple. I can't crap a cactus. That's your president.
I think that
this is how these guys talk in the back room. And Reagan would always tell these Irish jokes that were pretty gross too. And Tip would match it with his. This thing about matching each other. I don't know about you guys, but I can't remember more than one or two jokes at a time.
I can't remember any.
And these guys had the ability. One of my brothers, Bruce, can do this, which is memorize every joke he ever knew and always have it ready to top the other guy. So they had these jokes. Reagan, when his career was really down and like before he got GE Theater, he was out there working in Vegas leading on sort of an act. He was a review act and he was telling Irish jokes. That's all he did was tell Irish jokes with that Hollywood brogue, you know. So this is how they talked. It could get Reagan. I think having gotten to know some of the Reagan people over the years, They like gross jokes. That was just one little thing they liked to do. I think Nancy likes them, too.
That's the key to good government, obviously.
Gross
now, Chris Matthews.
It loosens up the other side.
You know, when I started reading this thing, I was hoping that there'd be tons of lessons that are transferable here, and I think there are. But then at the same time, I said to myself, the reason that worked is because of the two men and their approach. So how transferable is the Reagan O'Neill world to 2013
America?
Well, it's
not a how-to book. It's a book of stories about how they did do it to sort of maybe inspire people to get back to that mindset. I mean, it's a different mindset. You're right. It isn't just like, you know, here's your operator's guide to being a leader. Mm-hmm. You have to know how to be a leader. But there are some interesting things that do fit fairly neatly if they decide they want to get along at some point, like after a couple more weeks of this brouhaha, and they end up with the debt ceiling, which is real, and they all sort of agree, except for the crazies on the right, they got to do something. They can't go deadbeat here. They were trying to get the debt ceiling through early in 1981 when Reagan first came to office, and he needed Democrats because Tip ruled at least a nominal majority in the House. So Max Friedersdorfer, who was Reagan's chief of congressional relations, came to the speaker and said, can we get some votes? And the speaker said, Yeah, you get some votes. All I want is a letter from the president asking for them so that they would be covered in the next election. Now, who thinks like that? Just a letter to each one of these guys, and all of a sudden, they're doing business together because it was like putting up the white flag. Neither side's going to gain on this issue. We have to get the debt ceiling through, so let's agree that we're not going to screw each other on it. So I want the letter. And he'd do a lot of that. He'd do things like that with Social Security, or he'd say, you know, who wants to raise taxes in 82? But if you give me 100 Republican votes, I'll give you 118 Democratic votes, and that way big business won't just be mad at us again.
Well, what it seems to me, I know you'll correct me if I'm wrong, what made the 50, I need 50 votes and I'll get them for you if there's a letter,
kind of
particularly
stuff.
Amazing. Didn't that come just a year or so after there was, I think you said this, it was not one GOP vote that Carter was able to get for a similar debt ceiling thing?
It's in the book,
So it's, right. So
it was like breaking loose what had been just a turf war, you know, almost, you know, what's that word? What do they call it? Burnt earth or whatever.
So just scorched earth.
Yeah.
Where you just fight for everything.
Yeah.
And the other side just kills people just to get a victory, a marginal victory, which helps nobody. In this case, they said, look, we can do this together. In that case, they said, we didn't want any Republicans. We'll just match your votes. But in other words, like the tax reform bill, which was tough on corporations, Tip said, I won 50 votes. And he made them sweat. You know, he's sitting over at the Phoenix Hotel having dinner with his crowd over there. Did I say that right? Dinner?
Dinner.
He's
having
he's having dinner with his crowd, waiting, knowing that Reagan was sweating it out. Then he called in and told Jim Baker, you got the votes, but then you got the passage.
You know, I didn't think of this. We're talking with Chris Matthews from MSNBC about Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work, his brand new book. Didn't occur to me, I should have, until I read this book, the whole Irish Catholic thing. Yeah. I mean, that they came from different backgrounds.
Well, Ronald Reagan was Protestant because his mom was Protestant. His dad was definitely Irish Catholic, and his brother Neil was raised Irish Catholic. I think they
How decided, does that matter, well, though, that whole...
Well, the Irish thing is real. I mean, there's a great Latin word for when you're with the Irish. I feel it, too. When you get together, there's a great sense of together,
yeah.
You know, and it's very emotional. And I'm not sure Reagan didn't lose a lot of that when he went to Hollywood, but it really worked in Hollywood professionally for him because when he got to Hollywood and he's doing okay, Pat O'Brien was huge in those days, the actor who starred in the Rocky Story. And he had a part of the room in the Warner Brothers commissary where you sat with him. He was the king. And there were guys like Spencer Tracy and all, but O'Brien decided who sat with them. Okay, and it was a bit tribal, to say the least. They let in a few non-Irish, like Bogart, but when Reagan came along, Pat decided to let him sit with those guys. It's like a Holy Cross sitting with the jocks. You know, it's the whole thing.
Who does he get? Well,
he went to Holy Cross.
He gets to sit with the jocks, and the Irish were the jocks. And then when it came time to cast the George Gipp, the Gipper, in that movie, which is enormous to us growing up, the Notre Dame Story, Newt Rockne, All-American. He decided to push him for the party. He went out there and pushed him for it. Reagan went back at his yearbook from Eureka, showed he could play football. Pat O'Brien went to Jack Warner and said, most people don't know a football from a cantaloupe. This guy's a football player. Give him the job. And he even did the screen test with him. So I really think he owed a lot to Pat O'Brien and the Irish crowd.
Okay. Yeah. Great picture of him catching the football, too. You have a million great stories about Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan. Tell people about when Ronald Reagan was nearly killed at the Hinckley assassination. What about Tip O'Neill going to the hospital?
Well, because Jim Baker, who I've come – he was real waspy, excuse me, SOB in many ways. But he was something to deal with. He knew how to do it. And he knew how important it was that the leader of the opposition, the second in line to the presidency, be the first one in to see the president. Now, Reagan almost died. They kept that really secret. The bullet came right near his heart. He lost half his blood supply internally. It was just horrendous. They didn't want that out. They didn't want the world to know that. So when they decide finally to let the speaker in. And he goes in, and I had an eyewitness there who said that he walked across the room, waved to the guy he knew in the room, walked over to the bed, knelt down next to the bed, and held Reagan's hands, both of them, and they prayed the 23rd Psalm together.
Oh, God.
The Lord is my shepherd. And I talked to Susan, Tip's daughter, who said he definitely knew that one. And so, and then he kissed him on the forehead, and Reagan said something like, thanks for coming, Tip. And it was very emotional, I bet, and very wonderful, I think.
We're talking to Chris Matthews.
And nobody knew about that. I got that from the guy.
That's a great story.
Nobody knew
it's
that.
A great story.
You know, I watch you on MSNBC. I say to myself, best job in America. But then I read your book, and I say, that was the best job in America. Did you appreciate it then, or did you need as the space of a couple of decades to realize how lucky you were to be right in the middle of this whole
thing?
Well,
I did keep a journal. And Reagan's diary, as you mentioned, is fabulous. And we did get, although Tip didn't keep a journal, we did get a friend of mine, Eric Schwartz, a young guy who worked downtown. He secretly kept a recording of every morning press conference with Tip. And I didn't know about this. I sort of heard about it, but we didn't want to put it out because we didn't want to be giving reporters verbates on what Tip had said. If you're there, okay. If you're not there, tough luck. That was our view because we wanted people to come. So I was able to put together with my journals and everything. So I must have thought it was important enough. But one reason I kept my journal was to keep myself sane. You know, a lot of times you have to write every day, just say, okay, here's what we went through last. This is brutal. We're trying this and some fights with him and me. You know, he'd blame me for something, which is normal in politics. But did I know it? I think I knew it. But of all the three or four things I've done in my life, the Good Friday Agreement up there in Northern Ireland, the first all-race election in South Africa, voting with Bishop Tutu, being with him, interviewing Mandela, the whole thing. And the Berlin Wall, which stands out as my favorite, into being in West Berlin and East Berlin, hanging around interviewing people and what it meant to them, standing with them in the middle of the night saying, what does freedom mean to you? As the Brandenburg Gate was going to open and people saying, I said, what was his Freiheit? What does it mean to you? And the guy said, talking to you. I will never forget that one.
Hey, so Chris Matthews.
Isn't that a killer?
That is a killer.
We've
absolutely
talked a lot on the show about, with Chris Lydon, actually. Chris and I and Marjorie is yet to see All the Way with Bryan Cranston doing LBJ.
I know,
and
I
how
he
heard it. Somebody called me this morning and said you have to see it.
It is beyond spectacular. Both Cranston himself and the play is just, it's a wonderful view of Johnson. If Tip O'Neill had had to deal with an extreme left wing of the Democratic caucus, like John Boehner's got to deal with an extreme right wing of his caucus, how would O'Neill have handled that?
Well, there's no comparison because Tip was on the liberal left side of the party. He was very patriotic, of course, but he wasn't what you call a movement lefty or anything like that. Well, there was one example, however, which was interesting, and I put it in the book. When he was when Reagan was going to meet with Gorbachev at Reykjavik, the deal-making deal, when they really sat down and talked about eliminating all nuclear weapons. Even though they didn't do it, that was the great moment when Gorbachev told the prime minister of Iceland, we have just witnessed the beginning of the end of the Cold War. We're talking about a big moment. Well, anyway, to get ready, Tip was always, and I never knew this, in the back room making sure that the Democrats didn't do anything to upset those talks. He didn't want any distractions or any. In the first talks in Geneva, he said, you know, he went over and represented Reagan in that first meeting and gave him the letter from Reagan saying he wanted to meet with Gorbachev. You wouldn't see that today. You know, Boehner going over for Obama to meet with Putin. You wouldn't have that kind of a situation. But that was more the norm back in the old days. Like back in World War II, when it was about to begin because of Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt sent Wendell Willkie over as his envoy to Western Europe. So, I mean, this was a natural American unity thing that we have really lost. But in this case, Reykjavik, Ed Markey, the senator now, and Ron Delms, who were on the Democratic peace, what he called the freeze movement. Freeze was big back then, and they wanted to freeze all production of nuclear weapons on our side because they thought that, well, that would sort of send a message or set good example for the other side, which you could argue wasn't going to do anything of the kind.
As Chris Matthews rolls his eyes, by the way, for those of you
not
watching.
Well, because it's very hopeful. It's very hopeful. And I mean, I'm supportive. Of course, we all were hoping that we didn't know how we'd get out of the Cold War. Maybe the freeze would work. But he brought Delms into the room, who represents Berkeley, and they always say Berkeley has its own foreign policy, and those two guys are very good friends. And if, according to the accounts I've been able to get, they sat in the room with Tip, and he said, look, I promised to back you guys on a freeze vote, and I'm with you if you want to have one. But it's not a good time to have a freeze vote to embarrass the president when he's going over to meet with Reykjavik on this very important, perhaps war-ending meeting. And they're all crying in the room because they all decided that this was a moment. They could have won the big vote, but they knew it was in the interest of the country. And they all decided, Tip said, it's up to you guys, but they decided not to do it. His ability to bring people into a room, the speaker, and get them to sort of agree, even though I don't know how he did it, but he had a number of tricks. One was, if there's two guys fighting over turf, over who has the committee with legitimate jurisdiction, and sometimes I wondered how people were so dumb as to fall for it, he would yell at the guy he agreed with. And don't you do this again. And the minute I heard him say it, he just agreed with the guy. What do you mean, don't you do it again? And then they'd come out of the room with the guy who lost the fight but didn't know. It's like, God, he really tore him a new one. You know, I'd say, didn't you see what he just did? But he also would, you can't do this today. It's not politically correct. He would close the door to his room. It was always in his room. He'd sit behind this big desk, like a judge's desk, smoking that stogie, the big one, well lit. The room would get hotter and hotter. I think he actually had Leo turn the heat up, you know, Leo deal. And it got so hot and smoky in that room. And he'd never get out of that desk. He made people sit around him like an auditorium around him. He's the boss. And he would listen to both sides. And I love watching them. And all you could think about is how great it's going to be out of this room. And go, because the Capitol was always incredibly air-conditioned in the summer. You know, it was like an igloo. I mean, you walk out in the room, and, great, it's cold. I love this. And you could breathe. And I think he knew he could limit the length of a meeting that way.
So, Chris Matthews, you just said that
I know he did.
Talking about American unity, that we've lost it.
Yeah.
So why do you think that is? Is it the people or is it the time or is it the media? Why have we lost it?
Well, the media doesn't help, but anger. You know, it's just this deep gut anger, the hatred. In some court, I'm not saying Republicans all hate Obama, but some of them do. About 20%.
So is that Fox News and Rush Limbaugh?
No, these guys, I think they're exploiting it. I think it's there. It's part ethnic. Let's be honest. It's the Bertha thing is all ethnic. It's part hatred of Washington, which is pretty American. But I guess it's the economic squeeze. I don't doubt this thing people talk about, this cultural change, demographic change. If you live in a small southwestern town and it gets more and more Hispanic, well, most people would be upset. It's just too much change. There may be a few people, but when all of a sudden your whole world is different, the languages you hear are different, the people look different, it's harder to take. I think that's part of it. I think the economic squeeze on the middle class is part of it. But just people in a bad mood. I mean, look at this guy, Cruz. He's not a happy-looking guy.
He's not happy.
But, you know, he, without being too specific, just think about when I grew up. Who did everybody like in my family? My mom, for example. When I went home, we first got our TV set. You know what was on? McCarthy hearings. She wasn't rooting for the witnesses. She was rooting for McCarthy, okay? I knew who Mary Shields was rooting for. So the anger against the establishment is not new. I mean, real anger against the establishment. That explains McCarthy. He had a 4.5-year run where everybody's scared to death of him. And to that extent, it's like Cruz. People are really afraid of him. Today, and it just came out on the wires today, an hour or so ago, Boehner has now pulled back the word that leaked out that he might be dealing with a coalition, not with a straight Republican thing. He might be willing to end this fight.
Violating the so-called Benny Hassett rule.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And I think that, or even violating to the point of including any Democrats in his coalition to end this thing. So he's scared to death of the right still. And I think that's a lot like McCarthy must have been.
How does it end? And
begins to end. Just because of the pain of these closings and all. How about every time you go through an airport now, which I do all the time now, and you know, Tina and I were talking to the TSA guy, he's not getting paid. And he's the guy watching that scanner. You know, he's watching.
Wait, I thought they're essentials. Are they not essentials?
Well, they have to work, but they're not getting paid. That's the combination.
I didn't know that either.
They have to work, and they don't get paid.
Isn't that a violation of some
label? And I know a guy who's got
label?
A really high-level job in TSA in the back room, when they study all this data, he's not getting paid. So this is going to – you could do this for a week. Without a lot of pain. Some families don't live every week to week. They can make it. Then the second week, they can't quite make it. Or they barely make it. By the third week, people are out of money. And so they got to pay bills. So this is going to get really hot. And I think also the uncertainty about whether they'll ever get back pay. They're not necessarily going
to
get it.
That vote today is going to pass in the House to agree up front to give them retroactive pay.
Imagine,
but it's not going to pass the Senate, right?
We'll see. I don't know.
Hey,
but I do think that's the thing that's wearing at us. But the big thing, of course, is October 17th, and when we go dead beat.
Yeah, very scary.
And I hear that the 24th, the checks don't go out. Like, you know, I said that people used to have, like, an airliner. If an airliner said 95% safety record, you wouldn't get on it. You look around for the 100% safety record. 100 years now, people have been putting their money in the United States because we're the 100% safety record. We've always paid the paper boy who had a savings fund. He always knew he didn't make the most off the government when he bought a savings bond, but he always got the money. The Chinese billionaire who hates us, he always gets the money. Now we'll be a country that doesn't necessarily give you the money. There was that screw up in 13, remember? And that becomes part of our record. And that means all the interest rates have to be higher to get the money, right?
Yeah, it's
very
scary.
And we become like some state that had Illinois or somebody that doesn't pay its bonds or somebody.
Detroit.
This is really scary. And I think almost 80% of the Republicans agree with the Democrats this is something that has to be dealt with. But you get some of these characters, sagebrush right-wing Republicans. I had a guy on, this guy King from the Midwest. I said to him, and this is the last time we did this, 2 years ago, in 11, I said, well, aren't you worried about a default? He said, no. I said, why not? He said, don't you listen to the international economists? He said, I don't listen to international economists, like they're foreigners. And then I said, what about domestic economists? Well, they're intellectuals. He said, I don't listen to them either. They're intellectuals. So I said, how do you make these judgments? He said, I raised a family. This kind of horse sense.
From the gut.
Does anybody fix their own teeth?
No.
Does anybody fix their own plumbing? You usually go to a guy that knows what he's doing, or a woman. With this idiotic notion of I can do it all, I can think through these complicated issues, you got to be stupid to think
hey,
that.
Hey, before you go away, your last book, what was it called? JFK, Elusive Hero. Chris Lydon was here yesterday, and we were talking about James Douglas's book, which is Unspeakable, which is obviously back in the news. Even Jesse Ventura has written a book about the assassination. We're almost on the 50th anniversary of JFK. Where are you
I'm totally with the
Commission?
I'm totally – well, I don't want to call it that because that sounds derogatory.
Well, the Lee Harvey Oswald.
I think Lee Harvey Oswald did it. I think his pattern of going after Edwin Walker before that, General Edwin Walker, thinking he was going after Nixon. He got confused about that. I wrote about it in my book on Kennedy Nixon. I think the Bugliosi, I believe completely what he has to say. I look at it this way because a lot of evidence about, you know, they were all looking up at that window. They thought that was it. But my big question to the – I challenged Jesse in the hallway the other day because I think they're all crazy. But I think it's brain soup more than evidence. Lee Harvey Oswald has that job at the Book Depository way before there was any motorcade route set up. So if you believe there was a conspiracy, you have to believe that the Kennedy people themselves, the Irish Mafia, Kenny O'Donnell and those guys, systematically brought Kennedy to where he would be shot. And if you can come up with any other logical explanation or the pure coincidence, and if it was a coincidence, why would it be a big conspiracy about shooting him there involving Oswald? Because they always admitted it involved him in the conspiracy. So how could they have logically... Only a crazy person thinks like that. Like the people who say that Obama's mother married a guy named Hussein Obama in Kenya and went over there to have the baby so that she could deny it later. What are we all, nuts? And I just think, and I confronted him with that, and then he starts giving me all this FBI, CIA, and the Irish, because they all had to do it. And the people that are willing to believe in these conspiracy theories are willing to go full moon on this. They will tell you everybody was out to kill him. Now, I'll tell you a story about the Kennedy guys around him. They loved him. And everybody knows they loved him. And one of the great stories is our parish's Blessed Sacrament right on the D.C. line. And not far from me, about a mile walk from me, is Gar's funeral home. And everybody goes there eventually. That's where you go, okay? And that's where the Irish Mafia, Kenny O'Donnell, Larry O'Brien, those guys, and Dave Powers all drove up that night, the 22nd of November, 1963. They drove up by themselves to pick out a coffin for their friend. These guys love the guy. And the idea that they would participate in this is an absurdity, and it's cruel. And that's why I think guys like Jesse have just got their own psychological problems.
Go see All the Way before you leave town, even if it's standing room. Hey, okay. Chris Matthews, great book.
Oh, hey, thank you.
Good to see you.
And so, great conversation, too. We've been speaking. You recognize the voice, MSNBC host Chris Matthews. His new book, Tip and the Gipper, When Politics Work. You should really read it because it's very hopeful. Thanks again for being here, Chris. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. This is 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Which is it? Who you know or what you know?
I think about this all the time. What would have happened to me if I didn't have that access, if I didn't have that outlet? Would I have been as successful as I am today? I don't know.
I'm Kai Ryssdal. Talent, hard work, and how much it's worth. Meritocracy, next time on Marketplace from APM.
Tonight at 6, here on WGBH Radio.
WGBH programs exist because of you. And four centuries of Massachusetts furniture, where you can see extraordinary furniture made in Massachusetts from the 1600s to the present at museums and cultural institutions throughout the state. Details at fourcenturies.org.
And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us in Studio 3, as she does every Friday afternoon, would be the host of Greater Boston and the woman behind Emily's List, Emily Rooney. Hi, Emily.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi, Emily.
How are you?
I'm great. Can't wait to talk to you.
Yeah.
So you are not happy about the prison conditions involving Zohar Tsarnaev, the alleged marathon bomber. What's the deal?
No, I'm not. First of all, and I don't want to sound like a total bleeding heart liberal here, but he hasn't been convicted of anything. And he's being held in solitary confinement in a federal prison. I don't believe in solitary confinement for anybody. I was just watching the ticker in the other room when I was waiting to come on, and there was some guy who just died. He was let out of jail on Tuesday. He's been in solitary confinement for 40 years. That's just not right. These people are – they're people. They're not animals. I don't believe in it. And also, the other thing is, if you want to get some cogent words out of him and maybe some – compassion and some understanding of what all was going on in his mind, keeping him in these kinds of conditions is not going to do it.
Well, it's not just solitary. From my understanding, is he also cannot have any communication except with immediate family members.
I don't think he's allowed to read a book, a newspaper, a piece of mail, nothing.
So, and the legal team has been prevented from even coming in to talk to him.
Well, to a degree. They say they haven't had enough of the kind of access they need.
They have been prevented at least once from
coming
in.
There is some limitation on their freedom to even discuss certain things with him that the government considers to be a national security
issue. Am I the only one who feels this way?
Well, you know, I'm getting very upset with the federal government for many reasons.
Exactly.
And I am upset by this because I think it's different than how you're treated as a state prisoner who's in for a violent murder or maybe even many violent murders. And I'm upset about the fact that the other guys, there are three of them, that helped him get rid of his backpack.
Their students, they're UMass Dartmouth students.
Yeah, these guys, okay, you know, nobody likes the fact that they helped this guy, but they have been in jail.
The third one is out
because he's a local kid. He's from Cambridge.
Yeah. Yep.
But the other two, and I get it,
and
because they're not American citizens and they're the flight risk issue. But these guys are going to be in jail for obstruction of justice, possibly for who knows when this trial is going to take place.
25 years.
Well, I mean, they're held now, pre-trial.
I understand.
And
I agree with you.
The feds are just overreaching, for my money, in many instances.
These kids committed a stupid act.
But by the way, I'm totally with you on the kids. I mean, the notion that there's not a reasonable bail, I tend to agree with this. But in terms of the Tsarnaev thing, I have to say I'm mixed. Generally, I believe, you know, humane conditions are the way to go. But what is the proper – he shouldn't be in the general population.
Why
should
not?
He or should he? Well, I assume if he's in the general population, he's probably dead pretty quickly.
Why would he
My
be killed
assumption,
any more than
Because
you know, any
it's
other...
a pretty high-profile crime that affected a huge number of people. And my guess is amongst prisoners who probably like to think they're patriotic or something, that there's a lot of anti-Tsarnaev animus. I assume that's part of
I
the motivation.
I wish I thought that was the reason the government was keeping
I'm not,
him. They don't care, you know. It's just a matter of it's they're punishing him. They're keeping him in solitary confinement.
Well, there's an issue about cruel and unusual punishment. And when does it become cruel and unusual?
Well, there's a bill going through the House right now about that, about whether solitary is cruel and unusual.
Yeah, well, many people think it is.
How can anyone argue that it's not? And by the way, please don't send emails suggesting, I'm at least speaking for myself, Emily and Marjorie can speak for themselves, that we're suggesting any sympathy this Tsarnaev kid.
Here's the
but
thing.
But that's really not the
I'm
issue.
I'm not sympathetic.
Here's the thing. You segregate prisoners for their own safety. Aaron Hernandez, I am sure, is segregated from, from the general.
I think he's in his own cell, but I think he is mingling with the general population.
Well, he may be mingling a little bit now, but the reason he's not going to be in the – I don't think he's in the general – I could be wrong about that. I don't think he's in the general population because he's a high-profile target. It's for their supposed to be for their own safety, not to impose these very onerous conditions.
Well, but the government is suggesting that one argument, I believe, in addition – I don't know what they're saying about protecting the prisoner – is the guy, just like the mother, taped the phone call she had with him and they're using it to try to excite some sympathy for him. Is the government's contention – I'm not supporting – I don't know enough to support it or criticize it – is suggesting the guy is a terrorist. And the potential, if he had the ability to freely communicate with the outside world to incite others to perpetrate similar acts, is there? And I don't know enough to know if they're right about that.
He's not giving interviews to 60 Minutes. I mean, I can understand certainly that. We don't want to necessarily go into prison and interview him. But he has not yet, I mean, been convicted.
Well, didn't we read the other day the 1,000 people have – was it 1,000 people have written him?
Yes.
I assume he hasn't seen him based on what we've read.
I don't know.
Should he be able, Marjorie, to respond to those 1,000 people, then have him go on Gawker or TMZ or something or in the Washington Post or the Boston Globe or Herald?
I get that part. But I certainly don't understand what is wrong with being able to read something while you're in prison or why you cannot have some sort of contact with other people on a regular basis, just a little bit.
I completely agree.
So you don't lose your mind.
You lose your mind and you lose your ability to think cogently. And as I say, once he gets on the stand into a courtroom, having been in those conditions for – it could be a year and a half from now.
No, that's true. That part is true.
You know, it's not going to be in good shape.
Can we
stay on
the
crazy the last time.
What's that?
He already looked crazy. He came into court with
And by the way, one last thing on this. When we had the Jared Remy situation, the young man who was accused of murdering his girlfriend, and he is not unique. When you get these guys that go on to murder their girlfriends, you find that they have had a long history of coming close to murdering their girlfriends when they've beaten them up and stuff like that. We do not jail violent people who attack women with a regular basis. I mean, the dichotomy between the federal prisons and the state prisons and the county prisons, it's just the justice is very unequally meted out. If you ask me.
Okay, so
you're
let's
right.
stay in the law enforcement world
Thank
for
you,
a minute.
Emily.
There are two police tales in the last couple of days that bear mention, Emily. One is, and there's a great photograph at WGBHnews.org of Mel King, 85 years old, activist for, I would say, most things good for 50 plus years, and obviously the only person of color to make a mayoral final in 1983 against Ray Flynn. One, well, let's start with that one. Handcuffed following a housing court protest. Suggests you think it's a bit of a cross. It's a
total
little bit much.
Disgusting. First of all, it was a gimmick. Guys, it's a gimmick. He's protesting at the Boston Housing Court over these so-called no-fault evictions because an iron worker had been evicted even though he was trying to figure out a way to pay his mortgage and all that. They evict this guy. And, you know, Mel was not wrong. So he's at Boston Housing Court protesting these no-fault. It's like he's 85 years old. He's sitting on the steps. You think people couldn't have gotten in and out of the courtroom around Mel King? It wasn't like there were thousands of people. And there's a cop there hauling him away.
He's shackled.
And by the way, pushed one of our reporters out of the way on the one. Well, get out of my way. I'm important business here. It's like, is this what we want our Boston police officers doing?
Well,
I'd rather have them going out, you know, arresting and figuring out who's going to kill their girlfriend next, wouldn't you, Marjorie?
Yes.
Or protecting Isaura Mendez's nephews or people like
that.
So on a related note, I have a feeling this one, well, I don't know where you'll end up. Ben Swan is a longtime state legislator from Western Massachusetts. Apparently he's been filing a bill year after year that no one pays any attention to. All of a sudden it's getting a lot of attention, which would suggest that if a law enforcement official, if a cop, used profane language or ethnically laden language when speaking to a member of the public, either a suspect or whatever, it would be a cause for dismissal. What's your take on that?
Love it.
Wait, you love it because it's a great story? You love it because you agree with them?
The cops all use foul language. And they're so superior anyway, for heaven's sakes. And here they are, you know, dissing you, you effing this, and you this, that. And that's like, yeah, sure.
So you think it's okay. How about you, Marjorie? I'm dying to hear your take on this.
Jim, I'm particularly interested in your take on this because you accused a state trooper of unleashing
a whole
flurry
of F-bombs.
I did. What do you mean it was great? You weren't there.
I heard all about it.
How'd you like it? He talked about it for weeks.
I heard it in detail.
Well, let me explain to you. I would say there's a difference. I'm not defending. In normal settings, 99 of 100, I believe it is totally inappropriate. Mine was one of the inappropriate ones. My alleged offense was allegedly an illegal U-turn and driving over an island on Morrissey Boulevard. And
did it
turn out, I don't remember.
Like
it did turn out. I was acquitted
like
on one of the
British
By the
Prime
way, there
Minister.
Was a trial. Well, I didn't know it was a British Prime Minister at UMass.
He was very busy. We had to go.
In any case.
We're all stuck in traffic.
Prime Minister Brown happened to have been there, but I didn't know that. And I was convicted on one count and acquitted on the other following a trial. Now, do you think dropping 30 F-bombs on me in like 10 seconds, that's appropriate
did he do
use?
That?
Yes, he did.
Yeah. So you should have been, that case should have been dismissed.
I agree.
On that alone.
I agree. And I had one of the finest lawyers in Massachusetts, and I won one.
That's right.
And I lost one.
I was a hostile witness.
Can I tell you, were? She was. I had a subpoena. This is a true story. This is pathetic.
What?
No, it's a long story. It's too painful.
Because I saw what he did, Emily. Yeah. Oh. He wanted me to fudge the facts.
You want to see it? I didn't. I told you what my recollection was. I wanted to see if it comported with
yours. I would have done the same thing.
Okay,
I would have been right behind you with that U-turn on Morrissey Boulevard, right over that island.
By the way, believe me, you would have.
Oh,
okay, Emily.
Trust me, I would have.
It is that time. Yes. We come to it every week at about this time. Now, here it is.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
You know, usually we have no idea. I love when Emily laughs at herself here because I do too. We usually have no idea what you're going to do on Emily's list. Today we have a smidgen of an idea and I love it already. Take it away, Emily.
Yeah, these are commonly used phrases, overused phrases, stupid phrases, things that aren't used in the right context. So I'm going to start with those, things that aren't used in the
right
context.
This is right up Marjorie's alley, by the way.
So this one begged the question, and people use it all the time. Somebody just used it in our newsroom yesterday.
Ooh.
As if it means raise the question, but that's not what it means. It's when it means.
I use this.
What does it mean?
I feel terrible.
it means basing a conclusion on an assumption that needs proof. Like I use this one just to make something very very simple so everybody can understand it. Jim Browdy went to a haunted house and saw a ghost. So that's begging the question. It's like, what do you mean a haunted house? They haven't proved yet that the house is haunted, yet they're using that as the basis for the conclusion of course you went to a haunted house, you saw a ghost. So it's stating something in the beginning that the ear should go, what? What do you mean? It's not true.
So why do you think this bothers you as much as it does? It bothers Marjorie as much as it bothers you.
It's just irritating because people use it all the time, saying it begs a question when really all it does is raise a question.
Oof.
Like, ironically. Almost nothing
always
is ironic.
Always totally right.
It's coincidental. It's not ironic. It's coincidental. And irony is a tougher one to explain, actually. But, you know, there's a twist when something is ironic. there's a coincidence when it matches something.
It's okay. Ironic, you know, that you mentioned that. I know what it is.
A few things.
Go ahead.
Having said that.
Which I say all the time.
And that said. Drives me nuts.
But those are not improper usage. Those are just terms that are overused.
Literally, it's an improper thing.
Improper use.
Very unique.
Well, that's an all right. Here's
either,
one.
You're either unique or you're not unique.
Speaking of very unique. This is unique to Boston and Bostonians.
They say, I could care less.
That's right.
When what they mean is,
I couldn't care less.
Or,
exactly.
Jim Browdy's wearing a checkered shirt today.
I am.
And the other person will say, and so aren't I. What?
That's totally
that is
a Boston
totally
thing.
Boston. What do you mean, so aren't I?
Yes.
How about wicked? All right.
No, but so aren't I. When so I first moved here a couple of decades ago, that was the first thing I heard that I had no comprehension of whatsoever.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear you say that on Greater Boston and see what kind of reaction.
Yeah, exactly.
What else you got?
These are a couple of, and here's a list of totally overused. Iconic, toxic, awesome. Everything is toxic. Everything is iconic. Is there anything that isn't iconic anymore? Everything.
You know what everything is also?
What?
An outrage.
That is
That's
an
true.
You know, my favorite.
This one was outrage. That was outrage.
And you know what everybody is? A hero. If you do,
everybody's a hero.
Virtually everybody
every
is a hero. No matter what you
hero.
Do.
That's
exactly.
Everyone.
Yep. I know.
Anybody who did it, every firefighter is a hero. Not necessarily.
What's the term? By the way, before we get to your next thing, what is the thing? What is the term that is it? Beg the question that you think is most literally, I think, on your list is the most misused thing in the English language. Is that
one is misused?
Okay, I'll never use it again,
or use it properly. But it's hard to think about how to use it properly. It's not that easy. Use my haunted house example.
Okay, that's perfect. What else you got?
I was confused.
All right, stupid and just aggravating terms. This one I can't even believe I'm saying it. Baby bump.
Baby bump.
I hate that.
Baby bump.
That's a big Carol thing.
It's awful. It's a big
Carol
thing.
We'll play the inside track on that. They love baby bumps.
All right.
Is that a baby bump?
New normal. Is everything the new normal?
Actually,
oh, 50
I
is
like
the new 60.
It's overused, but I like
the new normal.
Yeah.
And this is one that you just can't say in my presence.
By the way,
I'm
if you could see Emily, as good as her lists are, if you could see Emily delivering her list, it is so much richer than the lists themselves. Go ahead, Emily.
This is one, and also I hear it in the newsroom, and it makes me want to blow. No brainer. That's a no brainer.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
No brainer.
I can't say it because, first of all, almost nothing is. You got to think about things. What do you mean it's an oh, you're gonna, that's a no-brainer.
Shut up!
I'm going to kill you!
Oh, my God. You feel better. Tell the truth. Do you not feel better? You have a big smile on your face.
Are you writing these down so we'll never say them again?
Yeah. I've memorized them. I don't need to. Now, as Marjorie would say, having said that.
Yeah,
No, as I would say. So what's Greater Boston tonight is obviously Beat the Press. What are you doing?
Actually, we have a good one. And you guys are a part of it in a small way because you have the Reverend Eugene Rivers on as a regular guest here on Boston Public Radio. He's been in some hot water recently. Harold did a big piece on him talking about how the black community did not come together to get behind one minority candidate. Therefore, there was no minority candidate in the final two in the Boston mayoral contest. But it turns out he hasn't voted since at least 1997. And he's said other things that have proven to be not exactly on the money or accurate. And this editorial was written by the Dorchester Reporter saying that it's time to take him down a notch and the mainstream press gives him too much of a platform. So we're going to take a look at that.
And by the way, on Monday, when he joins us at 1 o'clock, the subject of our discussion with Reverend Rivers is going to be exactly those contradictions. And
so,
what else are you doing?
So that's
You're also doing something about the changes at my other workplace?
We're doing some changes at NECN, but we don't really know what they are yet.
Do you know anything that I don't
know? I don't
know
anything, but
okay,
I have
nervous.
To say, the idea that they're going to be focusing more on news, how can you argue with that?
Yeah.
Broadside,
I understand, is safe, Jim.
Broadside, the news with Jim Browdy.
Excuse me.
Broadside, colon, the news with Jim Browdy.
Hey, it's really been ironic having you here. Thank you, Emily Rooney.
Thanks for the question.
It's great. See you tonight.
Okay.
Emily Rooney.
Thank you very much. Emily Rooney is on tonight at 7 o'clock, Greater Boston's Beat the Press segment, which is absolutely fantastic. When we come back, it's time for our Friday news quiz, the Battle of the Booksellers. The owner of the Brookline Booksmith challenges the owner of Porter Square Books. That's up next on 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
For her role as an astronaut in the new movie Gravity, actress Sandra Bullock was suspended in air, moving in slow motion.
everything had to be very liquid, very fluid, and I made it choreography. I said, you know, just let your body figure out the choreography and let it be like a dance piece.
Creating the illusion of weightlessness on screen later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Castle Group, PR, digital media, and events partner to businesses that value local connections, international reach, and marketing intelligence, connecting Castle clients with their audiences for 17 years. TheCastleGRP.com. And the Museum of Science, where you can uncover a portal to ancient times at the new Dead Sea Scrolls exhibit. See what life was really like over 2,000 years ago. More information at mos.org.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. When it comes to selling books, I'm Jim Brown and she's Marjorie Egan, by the way.
We typically
think it's a David and Goliath dynamic, the independent bookseller versus the mega franchises and online behemoths. But today we're pitting independent bookstores, which Marjorie and I both love, against one another on today's quiz. Here with us in Studio 3 are David Sandberg. David is the co-owner, the new co-owner, by the way, of the Porter Square Books in Porter Square. Nice to see you, David.
Nice to be here.
And Dana Brigham is the manager and co-owner of one of Marjorie's favorite stores, right in her neighborhood.
That's right. I love it too,
Brookline Booksmith. How are you, Dana?
Very well, thanks. Great to be here.
Now, if we had invited you 5 years ago onto the show, and get a little closer to the mic, Dana, if you could, and we said, are you going to be here in 5 years? Well, you just bought this thing, but let's assume we had a show in 5 years from now. Let's put it that way. Are you going to be with us in 5 years? Is it going to be all online and all Barnes & Noble and that sort of thing?
I'll let Dana give a better answer from the perspective who was here, someone who was here 5 years ago. But I would say that certainly from the perspective of a consumer 5 years ago, I would have been pretty worried about it.
And how about you? 50 years, Brookline Booksmith, is that right?
53.
Yeah. Is it going to make it to 58?
Totally.
And why? What separates Porter Square Books, which I think is about a decade old, give or take a year, and your operations, 53? Why have you been able to survive where so many others have not, Dana?
Porter Square, and we offer just an amazing experience. And it's not just about books or cards or gifts. You get in there, and it's a personal treasure hunt, and there are people there you like to be with. And we evolve and evolve and evolve so that we stay viable.
Excuse me. Let me tell you why, because I spent a lot of time there. Number one, you have an incredibly informed staff that can tell you about the neat books. You have the staff recommendations.
Dana's smiling hugely, you have wonderful little places
to sit in the middle of the shelf, so you can sit there for an hour and a half reading different books. You have a wonderful, by the side, card and magazine section and a little gift shop that's there, so you can do a lot of things at one time. You can get the little gifts. You have a great kids section, so that you can also bring your pets in to the bookstore. I have brought my little dog, Harry the Pea, best dog from Sea to Sea, and your people give out little treats to the dogs so the dogs remember when they come back in. So it's a totally neighborhood operation, and it just, I haven't been to Porter Square only because it's a long way for me to get down at the end to Porter Square in Cambridge, but you put out of business Barnes & Noble's, which is right down the street. It was unbelievable. We all thought you were going to be gone, and Barnes & Noble's is gone, and you are still there.
So we are.
It's just a great place. And you stay up late. You stay up and late on Saturday night. What, till 10 o'clock?
11.
11 o'clock.
But it is, David, part of it is, I mean, you both in interviews I've read, it's you and your wife who bought the thing, and I've read interviews of Dana on the 50th anniversary of Brookline Booksmith, use the word community a lot. I mean, there really is this notion that you want people to come in, not just to buy books. You have events. You have another author series at both your places. I did a great thing with my former producer, Jack Gray, who wrote this Pigeon in a Crosswalk fabulous thing at Brookline Booksmith a couple of months ago. That's the key. And by the way, my good friend, photographer Mark Ostow, runs the coffee and food concession in the front place of your wonderful store.
I think that is the key. I'll also correct what I said before, which is my perspective from 5 years ago was that of a consumer. As a bookstore owner, I feel very differently now that I've been in there a year and a half.
How do you feel?
I think the future is fantastic for bookstores like ours, like Dana's, that have all those aspects that she talked about, because I think, Marjorie, you're absolutely right. Community is what it's about. People that shop at independent bookstores now, I think, certainly the people that shop at our store, and I'm sure, and the people that shop at Brookline, shop there because they want there to be a bookstore in their neighborhood. They want to support it as a local business. They feel that what they can get there in terms of the booksellers, the staff, they can bring their dogs, that's an asset that a community has to have. And like a lot of other community assets, if you're going to have it, it has to be supported.
Yeah, we got to start this quiz here. Let me just say that looking at the two of them while they're talking, if you were to just bump into them on the street, what would you say they did for a living? I would say they own independent bookstores. Do they not look the part?
Yeah,
they
really,
well, okay. I don't know. Jeremy looks like a surfer a little bit over there with his surfing shirt on or Hawaiian shirt.
So why don't you do this? Why don't you ask questions of a store in your hometown, okay, and I will ask questions of a store in my hometown. Marjorie, start it off.
Okay, ready to go, Dana?
Okay.
Okay. Here is Jimmy Fallon describing what some members of Congress did this week. What is it?
The reports that several members of Congress were actually last night while they were debating the bill. I could have avoided the government shutdown. This explains that one part where they said, the floor recognizes the representative from Margaritaville.
Stepped on a flip-flop.
Okay.
Drinking.
Drinking. You are absolutely correct. That's great. Thank
is that
you.
True, by the way? Is that really true? They were suggesting the reps of the Congress people were drinking on the floor?
I don't know. We missed that, Jim.
We should have asked Chris Matthews. Okay, you got to tie this up, David. Here's your chance. This narrator is reading a passage from a book. What book is it, and why is it in the news this particular week?
2 weeks at sea. It is good to leave the dock. A seaman belongs at sea, not tied alongside, overrun with bureaucrats and workmen with dirty boots. And we will be warm. You'll find this cold? Poutine asked incredulously. For the 100th time, Ramius told himself that Poutine was
okay, I think that gives us the feel of this. What book is the narrator reading from, and why is the book and its author in the news this week, David? He's thinking. I can describe this to you. He's thinking very hard. Yes. Do you know the answer? Well, then the question goes to Dana. Dana, you don't know either. Marjorie, do you know?
We flunk.
Well, I have the answer in front of me, so I do
That's
know.
Helpful. Very helpful.
It's Red October, and obviously its author.
Oh, poor Mr. Clancy.
The poor Mr. Clancy died this week.
He was only 66.
66 at his heart.
And young. We don't even know why, do we?
Oh, I didn't. I was looking. I was looking for the obits to find out what the cause of death. You know.
Yep, absolutely.
But I couldn't find it, so it remains a mystery. Okay.
You're gonna have to live that down, both of you. Once you know, there's certain questions you can get wrong, but questions about books are gonna haunt you.
Okay.
Go ahead,
Here's question number three for you, Dana. Here's Stephen Colbert. What dreaded event is he excoriating in this clip?
Is coming, folks. Run for your lives. No, wait. Don't run for your lives. That will make you healthier. And that's just what he wants. From day one, I have vowed to stop or die trying. And knowing my luck, I'd almost die and then get nursed back to life by
Okay.
Oh, brother. I do not know.
Do you know, David?
I'm guessing he's talking about the dreaded Obamacare.
Yes, he is. Oh, exactly. Correct. Give him the points and he ties it up. Do you have, by the way, is there like a Obamacare for dummies? I didn't think of that just for the second, because we were talking at the top of the show about how a lot of Americans are confused or intimidated by the attempt to understand. Are there books that not criticisms or praise, but actual explainers of Obamacare?
I haven't seen one.
Nor
after
have
listening
I.
to the top of your show, I think Jimmy Fallon should write one.
By the way, why isn't somebody writing Obamacare for Dummies? Isn't there a huge opening for that?
There must be. There
somebody
must
in
be
the works,
somebody.
As you're guessing. Yeah. Okay, the next question. Who took that question? Whose question was that?
That was Dana's question.
Was taken by David, now they are tied one to one.
One to one. Now it's David's turn.
Now, am I doing this Conan O'Brien one, judges? Am I skipping that question? I'm doing it. Okay, here it is.
It.
David, ready?
I'm ready.
Jump into a sizable one-point lead right here. Here's Conan O'Brien talking about KFC. How exactly did the chicken franchise join the Meals on Wheels movement? Listen.
KFC has just released a fried chicken takeout container that fits inside your car's so the good news, folks, America does still work. Yes. We can do anything.
Okay, so how did KFC join the Meals on Wheels movement? This is appalling, but it happens to be true. Go ahead, David.
I'm embarrassed to say that I don't know it because of following the news, but from context, I'm going to guess it's in the glove compartment.
That actually is close, but would be wrong. Dana, do you have any idea what KFC has done?
Cup holder?
Well, do we give a yes, judges? It appears they have made a mini KFC bucket that fits in your car's cup holder. By the way, that one act is shortening the average life of Americans by 1.7 years.
Smart is that? Think about how many things that you would eat if they could put them in your cup holder. You know what I'm saying?
It's actually brilliant.
Some raviolis.
Yes. On my way there today.
It's hard to eat the spaghetti. Okay.
Sushi.
Round three.
This is a question for Dana. Here's Piers Morgan breaking some major news.
Looking live at the famous panda cam at the National Zoo is going to shut down. Of course it is. Everyone enjoyed it, so let's shut it down.
Okay. Why?
Everyone enjoyed it, so let's shut it down. That's a great line.
Why did the panda cam go dark?
I assume because of the shutdown, the government shutdown.
That is correct.
That is absolutely that is correct. Now, judges, once again, pardon my confusion. Am I switching to the final question on that next page, a well-known institution? I am, David. David, you ready for this?
I think so.
How are you feeling about this quiz so far, David?
So far, I'm not quite at the mark where I thought I was.
But you're going to get there. You feel you're going to get there? Yeah. Well, that's the beauty. There's room for growth. It's incredible. A well-known institution was shuttered this week without an encore. Please have a listen.
Oh, man, this kind of bummed me out. After 70 years in business, is filing for bankruptcy. Or as the fat lady put it, so now?
Pretty funny. Okay, what well-known institution shuttered this week? What was it? Do you happen to know?
Actually, I believe it was because of a strike, not bankruptcy, that Carnegie Hall closed this week, but I don't know if that's what you're asking.
Judges, is that it or is not? It is not, judges. No, it is not. That may be true, but it's not what we're looking for. Dana, do you happen to know what the answer is?
I believe it's the New York City Opera.
It is the New York City Opera. That is exactly correct.
That's different for the Metropolitan Opera.
Right.
Okay, because when I first saw that, I thought, oh, my goodness.
And the workers are on strike at Carnegie Hall. Is that the deal?
Carnegie Hall canceled its opening night gala because of a strike by the stagehands.
So you can't use the oldest, tiredest joke in American history? How do you get to Carnegie Hall? Do you know the answer to that, Marjorie?
Pick it.
You're a pianist. Pick it. No, it's not. Practice.
Oh,
it's an old, tired joke.
Very good.
Now, before we get to the bonus round, what's the score, judges, if we can? 3-1, and Dana is winning. You guys, one of the things I love about both your places, and unlike Marjorie, I have been to both. You notice that? I've been to both. You guys do a huge number of readings with the authors, community events, that sort of stuff. Tell us, starting with you, Dave, what's coming up in the near future that people could take a piece of?
I apologize that I don't know specific dates, but some of the people that we have coming up is Tracy Chevalier, who wrote The Girl with the Pearl Earring, has a new book out, and she's coming at the end of the month, I think on Halloween night on the 31st. Juno Diaz has a new book out, and he'll be coming.
Are these first-come, first-served things when you have authors there? Because some of them are huge, I know. Is that how it – did people get tickets? So they just show up at the assigned time? What's the deal?
What we try to do – and I'm sure Dana will tell you about someone who's coming to their store next week. It really depends on the author. And when we think there's really going to be tremendous demand for someone where we might not have the space, we'll often have it at a venue other than the bookstore. Mm-hmm. And we'll often give away tickets just so that we don't suffer overcrowding and not be able to let people in. But we usually try to do them at the bookstore where we can based on the size of the crowd. And to let everyone in who comes.
What's the website, since you don't have the dates in your head, but is there a website where people can check out these dates?
PorterSquareBooks.com.
PorterSquareBooks.com, and the wonderful Porter Square Mall, I should say. Okay, Dana, you're up.
Okay, we have Jhumpa Lahiri coming next Monday night, October 7th, for her new book, The Lowland. And she'll be in conversation with Bill Corbett, well-known literary icon in Boston. We have Amy Tan coming up in November.
Wow.
And Alice Hoffman, Wally Lamb. And those are the big names, but as with Porter Square, sprinkled among those big names, you'll find something almost every night of the week at both of our places, local, literary, funny, you name it, we do it.
Do the big authors, this is a question of both, do the big authors do this because they know it's good for book sales, or do they do it because they actually like mixing with people who are the ones that buy their books and read? No, I'm serious. I mean, while it's a wonderful thing, and I've been to events in both your places, why do the big names do this, David?
My view, especially, you look sometimes at the events that we have in the context of what these guys are probably selling of a new book. We're not selling a large number of books compared to how many they sell through other sources. I really think it is they like connecting with their audiences, and in an admirable number of authors, it's they want to support independent bookstores. I've had number of authors, even since we've owned the store, come in, and the first thing they say is, whether you buy my book or another book, shop in stores like this. It's important.
Great. How about you, Dana? What's your sense of their motivation?
The same. And they love to be among people who love books, and that you will find at any store like ours, and the customers who who give us their business. It's just a love fest.
Okay. You know, it's really terrible. The people who go to bookstores, and I've seen them.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
They go into bookstores, they get all the advice on the different books, and then they go home and they buy it online. I think they should be arrested.
Or a cattle prod should be used on them. And I am totally with you.
Tased.
Okay, the bonus round. Do you want to read the explanation of the bonus round, Marjorie?
Yeah, because you guys are independent booksellers, we're going to ask you questions about the movie You've Got Mail, about the budding romance between an owner of a gargantuan bookselling franchise, played by Tom Hanks, and an independent bookseller, played by Meg Ryan. I love this movie. So and the twist is that even though they know each other, unbeknownst to them, they are booting up an online romance using... I always mispronounce this.
Aliases.
Thank you. Aliases. Okay. I always say aliases. It's very embarrassing.
Well, we got the concept across.
Okay.
First question is to Dana from you.
Okay, Dana, you ready? What's the name of Meg Ryan's bookstore in You've Got Mail? A, Shop Around the Corner. B, Old Friends Bookends. C, Once Upon a Time.
Shop Around the Corner.
That is correct.
With no hesitation. Now, David, I have very good news for you.
Good.
Because I am in charge of the quiz this week, and because it's 4-1, the next question is worth 3 points. And I live in Cambridge, and not that far from you.
Wait.
I'm sorry, Dana. You've got Marjorie, he's got me. Which of these is the first line of Roger Ebert's review of You've Got Mail? A, the appeal of You've Got Mail is as old as love and as new as the web. B, return to sender. You've Got Mail is nothing more than a postcard-thin remake of Sleepless in Seattle. Or C, You've Got Mail seals the deal. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan are today's Hepburn and Tracy. Is it A, is it B, or is it C, David, please?
I'm going to assume he took the cynical viewpoint and say B.
Sadly, that would be wrong. Now, Dana, you may, as we call it, steal this particular question. Is it A, the appeal of You've Got Mail is as old as love, or C, You've Got Mail seals the deal? Which would it be? The non-cynical reviews. Which one would it be?
I'm going to go with A.
Well, that would be correct, Dana. That would be totally correct. Now, I think in the spirit of fairness, Marjorie, this is the last question. Is that correct?
This is the last question.
So you should ask it of David.
Okay, David.
Is that fair enough?
Ready? What?
Will I get a free cup of coffee if this works out,
Absolutely.
David?
Absolutely. I'll speak to Mark about that.
Okay, fine.
What online alias did Meg Ryan's character use? A, Shop Girl. B, Book Babe. C, Lit Chick.
He's thinking.
I'm going to go with A, shop.
No, you are correct. You are correct. Now, I bet because this was sort of a girl flick. Did you even watch this movie?
I did. I was required to, yeah.
Okay, just checking.
But I also really enjoy the original movie that it was based on, The Shop Around the Corner.
I never saw that. Who's in that?
Oh, it's... like from the 40s, and I don't remember.
Is that a horror movie?
No. It's a lovely romance.
Oh, it's a lovely
and
romance.
Another
okay.
piece of trivia, there was a Broadway show called She Loves Me that was based on that musical.
Oh, really?
Give him a couple extra points for that, please. Thank you very much.
Now, I also love that sappy Sleepless in Seattle, too. I've seen that about 17 times.
Are the independent, we only have a couple of minutes left, a minute or so. Are the independent booksellers, is there a competition or is there a collaboration? Because you really have stood up to the Goliaths here. David, starting with you, obviously this Harvard bookstore we know, and they're a dwindling number, at least in greater Boston. How do you work together? Or do you work together?
This is one of the things, actually, since coming into the business so recently, I was most delighted to find out, which is that bookstores like ours and like Harvard and Wellesley, and I'd say there's a much greater sense of camaraderie than competition. I think we see each other really as much more in the same boat and trying to make headway against a common challenge, which we all know what that is.
You buy that, Dana? Are you there?
100%.
How long have you been doing this, Dana?
32 years.
32 years at Brookline Booksmith?
Yes.
Look at the smile. Why'd you decide? You were a lawyer at Google or some such thing. Is that what you were in your former life?
I was a lawyer and then I worked at Google, yes.
And you were a customer, I know, of... Sure. Why'd you decide that... I was going to say it's not late in life, but in middle of life, did you want to become an independent bookstore owner?
We found out that this bookstore was for sale or was going to be sold. And as soon as we heard the news, notwithstanding having never thought before about owning a bookstore, we both immediately realized that it would be a fantastic thing to do and that we would love to do it if we could. And it's been a short time, but so far we seem to have been right.
We're happy about it, too.
Oh, yeah. It's just the best. Like I said, you know, you also didn't mention you have that cheap downstairs thing with the paperbacks.
Used books.
Where you can go down and buy the books down there. And it's just a community center.
I agree. I'm totally wonderful. With you on this.
Next to Starbucks, which is also nice because you can go in there and get your coffee so you can be wide
or
awake.
Or Pete's, depending on your point of view
exactly.
down the street.
That's right. Okay. Thank you very much, you guys, for being here. David Sandberg is co-owner of Porter Square Books. Dana Brigham is the manager and co-owner of Brookline Booksmith. And thanks for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. On Monday, we are going to be here with Open Mic with the Reverend Gene Rivers. He's created this huge controversy over Revelations that he has not voted in years. We're going to talk to him about that. We also have burning expert Vern Locks. And trust me, you do not want to miss Vern. Our show is a production of WGBH. You want to thank Chelsea, Amanda, Will, John, and Alan. And thank you guys for tuning in. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy. Have a wonderful weekend. Thanks for spending the week with us. We hope to see you Monday at noon. See ya.